This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica, un programa producido gracias a la colaboración de radios indígenas, personas que hicieron posible este programa. Yo soy Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Informativo has come to you on recording, and you're listening to WBAI. Listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City. I love the way she says WBAI. I like that. I guess it's time for Radio Unnameable. I have so many things I want to talk to you about, and we have so many issues that we're going to discuss. This morning, the issue of how come the aliens, the ones, those guys in the business suits, are taking away all of our culture, whether it's the way they rebuild New Orleans into a kind of working to make it into a kind of a cross between Disneyland and Venice, you know, and papier-mâché. There used to be a wonderful, wonderful coffee house on the corner of... my name is Bob Fast. This is Radio Unnameable. That's Bill Propp over there. And tonight, Steve Ben Israel will be here, and Juan Rivera, talking about things that you probably have an interest in. I think they might even impinge on the quality of your life, on your contentment, and your willingness to... what is that Chumbawamba song? I fall down, I get up again. Fall down, I get up again. I fall down, I get up again. I fall down, I get up again. That's what every day is sort of like that. You hear some atrocity, and then you get up again. I did hear something today that was like the correction of an atrocity, and among a certain tiny circle, which includes people who have listened to Monroe Littman, this is probably a well-known story. It's probably of no interest at all to the rest of you. But Monroe Littman saw a story that said that our mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, said that he had smoked pot and he had inhaled and he had enjoyed it. And he thought that that statement was going to change the Rockefeller drug laws. Well, he came rushing into Al Lewis's program, and I remember what I said when he said this. Al Lewis said that he wanted him out of the room, and that he couldn't just burst in, and he said it in a very, very big daddy way. He said that there was no free, meaning unhindered, uncontrolled, undisciplined speech on his program. But Monroe heard it much more narrowly. He thought that Al was saying free speech. Well, whatever. But the next thing, I remember the next thing that happened. I was there. I was in the room when this happened. And I said, now I'm going to say a word that some people find offensive, but everybody has one. So if you're one of those people who doesn't have this thing I'm going to say, tune away, whatever it is. If it offends you to hear a fairly universally known phrase, a sight of evacuation and love mentioned on the radio, you should tune away for maybe a minute. You'll be clean if you come back in a minute, okay? I said, Monroe, it doesn't matter. I don't believe that he inhaled. I don't believe that he smoked pot because he's such an asshole. You can tune back now. Call your sensitive friends. And he said, why? Why do you say that? I said, because he closed the libraries. And he had ordered that the libraries were to be closed for something. I don't know what reason, but they opened again. And now there's a real struggle to keep the libraries open at night because people come in there and they get culture. They have internet access. They have a chance to just sit in a cool place on a hot day or someplace where kids can, you know, educated, if that's not too crude a word. Anyway, I just thought about that, and see, I just realized something. We are broadcasting not just on WBAI in New York City, but we're broadcasting on KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, and in a place called Homer, Alaska, which has been described as a quaint drinking village with a fishing problem. Homer, Alaska. And we're broadcasting to these places, and it is not yet the safe harbor. So there might be some damage to someone's psyche. I wouldn't want that to happen, would you? Would anyone here want that to happen? No. So pretend I didn't say that. Okay. This morning on Radio Unnameable, we will be talking about why cities are planned to kill the people that live in them. And I don't know exactly whether you, Steve Ben Israel, has a title other than the wonderful title he has for the performance that he's going to be giving, which is Nonviolent Executions, which will be three nights, Friday through Sunday, June 26th, 27th, 28th, at the Theater Lab, which is 137 West 14th Street. So Steve will be talking to you and inviting you to come, and Juan will be talking about what they're doing to poor Coney Island.
I've been cut.
And that's the news.
Uh. los negros, cielito lindo, los contrabando.
Oh, WBAI is not going to be going to Clearwater this year, but hey, we won't stop you if you want to go. You'll have a great, great time. If you don't want to go to Coney Island, go to Clearwater, or go to your radio and listen to WBAI. That's Pete Seeger singing Happy Birthday. And he's been nominated at least by some large numbers of his fans and lovers for a Nobel Prize. I think that's a great idea. He deserves it more than a lot of people. Henry Kissinger got a Nobel Prize.
Ay, no llores, porque cantando el gran cielito, lindo los corazones de la Sierra Morena, cielito lindo viene bajando un par de ojitos negros. Cielito lindo, los están probando. Ay, 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 ay. Canta y no llores, porque cantando se le gran cielito lindo los corazones.
Pete Seeger. What a blessing of a man, huh?
Yeah. I remember the first time I heard him on recording. I could not believe the Weavers coming out of my jukebox, out of my radio. It was just wonderful. And then when I heard that they were... See, at that point... It was not subversive to be pro-democracy in this country. So,
you're talking about the Red Scare?
Yeah, before the Red Scare.
That was the second Red Scare. We had one in the early 20s.
Yeah, well, actually, they had one in the days of Andrew Jackson. They called it the Alien and Sedition days.
Yeah.
You know.
But that was before. That's before Marx. See, when Marx came on the scene, all of a sudden they said, "That's the guy we're picking."
That's a heavy one.
That's the guy we're up against. So we had the first Red Scare, you know, in the early 20s by Attorney General Palmer and his new lieutenant J. Edgar Hoover, you know, and they were doing the Red Scare after World War I, and Leto Sacco and Vanzetti were executed in 1927. But that Red Scare, you know, there was three German socialists and one Italian pacifist on the roof of Houston and Crosby Street, throwing leaflets off the roof about democracy and freedom and the IWW during the Red Scare. And came the cops. They took them right to the boat. Right to the boat. They couldn't even get their guitar, man. They went right to the boat. And like there was just getting them over there, thousands of people they were picking up at that time, and that's when people were like struggling, and people always struggled.
There weren't that many people who had telephones in those days, but every telephone below 14th Street was tapped in those days when it was that was like telephones were like a cup and a string, you know, like a Dixie cup and a string. They had somebody at every. In the customs house downtown, they had somebody whose job it was to, like, at random pick up the phones of aliens. and listen
there's,
in.
There's some weird jobs in capitalism. The guys who pick up the phones, that's a weird job in capitalism. You know, Tom Paine, you know, he sold so many copies of Common Sense 1 year that there was 53 printings in 1 year, and there was no cars, there was no email, there was no just send in $3.95 and we'll send it to you in the mail, be there, Fed Express. And he sold so many Common Senses that if you multiplied them by today's people, you know, he would have sold 21 million copies of Common Sense. That's how many copies of Common Sense that he sold, you know. And there was like, all right, load him up on a horse and wagon, we'll take him to the next town.
He was the Noam Chomsky who was there. Yeah, except he would be thrown out of most universities. He was hard-drinking man.
He was been just
hard-living and hard-loving.
Just re-recognized by the British, who've been doing a whole thing on Tom Paine in the universities all over England, you know? Because when Tom Paine came here, Benjamin Franklin brought him here. And Benjamin Franklin went over to this room where there was William Blake and William Godwin, who was Mary Shelley's father. Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, and they were all anarchists. And when Ben Franklin said, "We got something cooking in America right now, you want to take a look at this stuff?" And when Tom Paine came to America, he said, "Wow." You know, he saw something that you could work with. Of course, when he, you know, of course, years later when he came back here before he died, which he died on Grove Street here on 7th Avenue, 59 Grove Street, when he came back after being in jail in Paris because he was speaking to the people in Paris, when he was a guest in the revolution. You know, here's a guy from 1776, and we're going through it now, and Tom Paine gets introduced, and you hear, "Tom Paine, Tom Paine," in the audience, you know. And Tom Paine gets up and he says, "Brothers and sisters, I'm telling you, in the long run, it's better to have bread in the basket than heads in the basket." And he, like, they busted Tom Paine, put him in jail for a year and a half. Uh-huh. But when he came back here, this place that he came and helped build, create America, this vision he had, all the work that he did when he came back years later, he said, "What the hell happened here?" Already, so quickly, the corruption.
That's what Rip Van Winkle is supposed to be about.
I've been rereading Rip Van Winkle. Yeah. I've been trying to find out what he did after he woke up. Not that I've been asleep. Listen, my name is Steve Ben Israel, and I'm a performer here in New York City, and I'm doing a show called Nonviolent Executions, and I've realized that this year, around this month, it's 50 years I've been a performer. You know, like guys say, "I've been into this for 900 years. You know, and it's 50 years I'm a performer now, you know. And I do this, what they call the one-person show. Somebody once asked me, "Do you do performance art?" I say, "No, I do performance life. Stage is easy. Life is tough." So, danger, no culture. You know, and I tell this story when I was in Dusseldorf a couple of years ago being interviewed by Dusseldorf Radio. The guy says to me, "So, Steve, what will you be doing when you go back to America?" And in my head, I said, quickly, "Good question." But all of a sudden, I said, "I'm working on the ch." And he said, "What?" And I said, "I'm working on the ch." He said, "Pardon, Steve, but what is a ch?" I said, "In America, we got cult. We need culture. No culture, no politics." And I thought about what was the culture back there in 1776 when they were creating the United States of America, that the culture couldn't sustain the politics, that the politics eventually went, just like in England, a little different, back into the main line. You know? So today we see how important culture is. And I've been home a lot lately, and I've been watching the television, which I haven't done in many years, and it's very scary what they're doing to me. And I have to say, I have to find other things to do. And so I create for my my theater shows, a resistance to all this crap. 2009. The terror has come home. The war on error. The bailout, the downturn, the meltdown, the stimulus, the credit crunch, the interest rates, the downsize, the outsource, the National Recovery Act, the mortgage, the subprime, the TARP. Sounds like a high-budget horror movie to me. Halloween, Friday the 13th, Mother's Day, Motel Hell, Dressed to Kill, Maniac, Fade to Black, The Shining, The Changeling, The Howling, Don't Answer the Phone, He Knows You're Alone, When a Stranger Calls, Scanner's Blood Beach, Dawn of the Deadly, Deadly Blessing, Sleepaway Camp, Sleepaway Camp 2, and now the terror continues with The Foreclosure. The Foreclosure, you won't be able to afford to go see it. Don't open up your refrigerator. There's nothing there. The Foreclosure, closing down a house near you. So,
if you love this land of the free,
bring 'em home, bring 'em home.
Bring all troops back from overseas,
bring 'em home, bring 'em home.
It will make the general sad, I know. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. They want to tangle with the foe.
Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. They want to test their weaponry. But bring 'em home, bring 'em home. Here is their big fallacy.
Bring 'em home, bring 'em home.
A foe is hunger and ignorance. Bombs and guns,
bring 'em home,
bring 'em home.
I may be right, I may be wrong.
Bring 'em home,
bring 'em home. But I got a right to sing this song.
Bring 'em home, bring 'em home.
Isn't that the wonderful thing about America? You got a right to be wrong. Where else in the world can we do it like we can do it here? Back in 1965, when I first wrote this song, it was If You Love Your Uncle Sam. Support our boys in Vietnam and bring them home. And if you all sing that chorus with me, we can raise the ceiling a little higher.
And all those older guys, they said that he was mean and cruel, but you know, I want to play football for the coach. Said I was a little too lightweight to play linebacker, so that I'm playing right end. Want to play football for the coach. Cause you know someday, man, you gotta stand up straight unless you're gonna fall. Then you're going to die. And the straightest dude I ever knew was standing right for me all the time. So I had to play football for the coach. Man, I want to play football for the coach. It's been up for sale. And you begin to think about all the things that you've done. Just about everything. But remember the princess who lived on the hill. Who loved you, even though. Just might come shining through.
Mississippi John Hurt and the Mermaid Song. The Mermaid Parade is one of Coney Island's greatest attractions. Steve, did you ever see the Mermaid Parade?
I only on television. I saw shots on Manhattan Neighborhood Network Channel, uh-huh. And all of a sudden you're on channel, you know, like 56, and it's like bad audio, and the picture is wobbly, and there's the Parade of the Mermaids, and I just never got to it. But I have such a history with Coney Island, because I worked there in the merry-go-round in the mid-50s. Guy teaching me how to jump on and how to jump off, and it's a certain rhythm, or else you can get hurt. You know, like collect the tickets, make sure the kids are strapped up. You take those old leather batted straps and hook them up, you know, and so once in a while you get a really big kid and you can just Bailey, like, you know, put it on. And then, you know, and then, like, you get, you know, once you learn how to jump on and off while it's moving, it's something you dig doing. So there you are going around and around and around, and all of a sudden you decided to jump off, and you land like a ballet dancer.
Right.
And you know very soon you get the signal that the ride is going to close down in 30 seconds. So it's going around, and you jump back on and hold on, you know, and it ends, you know. So and all these kids, you know, and it's like such a buzz. There you are, you know, it's, you're going in the merry-go-round, and there's the golden brass thing that people are reaching out for. And, you know, and you had to time it so tight because every so often they lean off to the right and almost fall out of their strap. You had to watch that, you know. But, you know, I'm from Brooklyn, you're from Brooklyn, Bob, and... Coney Island was...
For me, it was the first place I ever ate an oyster. Wow, a clam, a raw clam.
The ocean and the sand, when you first experienced the ocean and the sand, you know, and then you figure out how to like, leave that place with all the sand off of you, that you can put your clothes back on, and you're like, you just walking in, you know.
Beach whole parties, late at night.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. After we got out of high school, we went down, and Huey Tobias stole my girl. He stole my girl. He was doing handstands, and she fell in love with him, and she went home with him. I had to go home alone.
Years later, I got on a boat on the North Deutsche Lloyd, the ship, the Brennan, and I took a six-day trip over to Europe to work. And, you know, I was pulling away, you know, and I thought all those times at Coney Island, what's on the other side of this, you know? And when you get on that boat, and there you go. But Coney Island and New York City, you know, I had a little section of my show where I called Changes in New York. And guys like me and you, Bob, who were born in the 30s, like, we've seen a lot of changes. We can be redundant and say, remember when the Daily News was 3 cents and the Times was a nickel, not $2? And when you can go to a movie for 14 cents?
Well, there were 7 newspapers in New York City.
Including PM,
right,
which Izzy Stone wrote for, right, which had no advertisements.
Right.
They didn't want to be swayed politically, you know? So when you've been alive in this town, even though I've been all over the world in my life, but when you even see now, Figaro is like an empty Mexican place, but it's like a McDonald's version of a Mexican place. You walk by there, that corner, McDougal and Bleecker, and there's nobody ever there. You see some guys in the back, like a cafeteria, ready to like dole it out to you, but there's nobody ever in there. So you get reminded of that every time.
I was talking about the Figaro before and how they turned it into a McDonald's, and then they tried to turn it back again. They built it was
a Blimpie.
It was a Blimpie, right.
Back then.
A papier-mâché recreation of the old Figaro.
Well, the guy did a pretty good job. Ed Gordon, who used to manage the Raffia in 61 when I worked there as a comedian.
They worked from photographs.
But, you know, I've been getting into poetry the last few years and finding how important it is, but just reflection on the city I live in, that one day I'm walking down 34th Street between 6th and 5th at like 12:30. It is so packed with people right across the street in the Empire State Building, and you can hurt your neck looking up because you will not see the top of it from 34th Street between 6th and 5th. And I go there every Monday, and it's like, it looks like a demonstration, but it isn't. and because people are going both ways. You know, but before you get to it, You think it's a demonstration. So just walking down the street, I had this reflection. 34th Street could surely use a miracle. I could use a small one myself. A miracle is something you meet halfway. On the corner, there's some young hip-hop cats hawking their homemade CDs, telling everybody that their stuff is real and representing. Now, real and representing is kind of elusive these days. Further down the street is a couple of Asian ladies with bright yellow T-shirts that say Reverend Park, telling us we have to go see this man because he will get us a one-way ticket to heaven when we leave the building. And there's the folks selling the $5 Chanel smells. And all of a sudden, a bunch of guys further up the street come up with these designer handbags, $195, but just $24.95. And their spotter spies the cops, and they scoot. And then I see a giant concrete flower pot with a bunch of beautiful little red flowers and some giant leaves. And I get closer and closer and closer to the leaves, blocking out the street like a kid that goes underneath his blanket with a flashlight, trying to discover the underground. Everybody else is shopping, working, moving fast, wondering where it is, even though they know they came in with it.
When you did that sound before, when you said you were looking for the
culture,
well, I thought, you know what I thought of the sound when the analog DTV, the analog TV stations went off the air, and suddenly, the set, like, my friend was, like, he wasn't there anymore. My obsession, my solace, my comfort, my drug, the thing that made me, like, forget the process server at the door.
800,000 people didn't get it together. We're not ready when this moment happened.
I sent away for two of those coupons. I got two of those coupons. I took them someplace, and I bought one of those things, and I bought an antenna, because I heard that if you didn't put an antenna on, it wasn't a very good signal, and I hooked it all up, and nothing. Nothing. No TV. Thank God for DVDs. Listen, this is WBAI. A lot of people say, thank God for WBAI. Oh, thank God WBAI is here. Wouldn't be worth living in New York City without it. If you feel that way, maybe you can go to our website, which is WBAI.org, and pledge a little money. And, hey, if you pledge $25, you become, ka-ching, a member. You are a member of this conspiracy to effect a change in the media, to make the media more responsive to the people that listen to it, to tell the truth over the radio, more or less. You become a member, and you can vote in our elections for our board of directors. And you should do that. If you care about WBAI, or if you care about yourself, you should become a member and, you know, exercise your prerogative, if you know what I mean. And you want to talk on WBAI, you know, our telephone number is 212-209-2900. And we'll be taking telephone calls in a while. But now, maybe you've been sitting there laughing a little bit, but most of the time, upon you, you haven't had a chance to say anything.
You're talking about stuff from before I was born.
Well, it's all related, because we're talking about Coney Island before and talking about the city, and I hear you're a town planner at one, right?
I'm sorry?
You're a town planner?
A city planner, yeah, that's correct.
A city planner. One of those guys, you know, you get one of those good guys, we can go somewhere good, you know. But, you know, I was telling you before, I go to community board meetings. That's like watching a rerun of a game that you root for, and you know they lost. But you watch anyways, because at one point I heard in the fourth inning, your team had the lead. But later on, they lost it, and they lost. So that's like going to a community board meeting. So one day at a community board meeting, after this coming, swelling up in me, how I really feel about this, one day I said, I understand what everybody here is saying, and I can agree with that, but until we understand that the white man has come again, and all the white people in the room, which was about 97% of them, went, and then I said, but you see, the white man can be from any ethnic group, and everybody started to relax a little bit, because it was, and what I mean, everybody knows who lives in New York City for a long time, whether even if you've been living there 15 years, the rape of this city by the tall buildings, the complete rape of this city, and with the heavy tendency to destroy the rent stabilization laws. And 6 years ago, they tried to sunset the rent laws. Governor Bruno up in Albany, you know.
He wasn't the governor.
It doesn't matter, whatever he was. Senator Bruno and his cohort. Who's the governor then? What's his name again? Pataki and Bruno. Yeah, they would have made great guys in the German army. You know what I mean? And they tried to actually sunset the rent laws. And when you went to the first demonstrations, you noticed that only 2,000 people showed up instead of 200,000. And you wonder why. And that's tied in with what they've done in Coney Island, right?
Right. I mean, it's a problem. It's been a challenge. So many people care so deeply about this place, and you go down the street. Our volunteers go down the street, and you tell people this is what they're doing, and they'll sign. But when it comes time to really apply political pressure, it's a challenge to get anyone involved. People have other things going on, and it's a sacrifice.
How do you tell them to put the pressure on? What suggestions do you make?
You know, it's a little bit of a guessing game, but you want to think that electeds respond to pressure from their constituents. Of course, in Coney Island, it's a little bit of a trick, and one of the big challenges there is that this is this place belongs to the city. It belongs to the world, but the political system prioritizes the interest of a particular group, residents, which, and they should be listened to. Well, of course they should. But the fact that this is a place for affordable recreation for New Yorkers of all backgrounds and incomes, for people from all over the world who've heard about Coney Island, that part doesn't really register. So what you get is the city looking at this prime piece of real estate that for a number of reasons has been half vacant, and what they see is, wow, this is a great opportunity, and this is being squandered, and we have to devote it to a higher and better use. What they're not really very upfront about is, well, this is a higher and better use for whom exactly? So all of a sudden you start getting, well, you know, market rate high rises on the western side of what used to be the amusement area. Well, what about some big retail, maybe themed retail on the base of that, you know, because the residential community is underserved. Well, you know, the residential community that's underserved lives on Neptune and on Mermaid. They're not on the amusement area. And you can speculate about who exactly those commercial uses are going to be serving, the market rate tenants or the underserved population of Coney Island. And that is not really getting to the question of, well, what is the function of Coney Island? This is not only about a higher and better use, whatever the hell that means. This is a place where people go to enjoy, and we don't really feel like it's being developed with that in mind.
Nothing is being developed with that in mind right now.
Right, well, that's
true. It does not exist. Once in a while, they say we'll build 10 or 20% affordable housing. That's part of the package. And they always say, we'll work with the community. Right? This is their lines. The way they get, they say that they will make affordable housing, but even that affordable housing is no longer affordable.
And it's hard to establish really a negotiating baseline for that. I think last year it was that 125th Street was, which was a very large city project, the council member there took a stand, and there was a panel of folks from the community that were put together, and they came up with a list of requirements, and they, I believe, obtained 80% affordability at the tiers of their own choosing. And you would have thought that at that point, from that point onward, that would have been the baseline for negotiations, but no sooner had that happened that it was forgotten. And now you have public land that is being given away. We don't really know, in Coney Island, we don't really know for what price. We don't know what level of affordability. They're talking about 20%. You know, here you were talking about 80. Now they're talking again about 20% with a bonus so they can build higher. So the developer gets land probably at a below market value. They can build higher than they otherwise would have built, and they only need to provide 80% at a yet-to-be-determined level of affordability. So it's really a land grab.
Wall Street, we're on Wall Street, right?
Yes, we are.
Wall Street was built as a wall from one side of Manhattan to the other side by 500 Dutch indentured servants. And they built this gigantic wall, which became Wall Street, to keep the Indians out. They showed you up front, we're taking this, and you ain't coming here because we built this wall. And as they got more and stronger, they didn't need that wall, because they became, a lot of Europeans began to come here. But for a long time, that separation on the tip of Manhattan, where we are, to the rest of Manhattan, was to keep the Indians out. When you follow the bouncing coin, the bouncing coin is about making profits. The bouncing coin will always say, and it will create jobs. And these people with these jobs will pay taxes, and they will buy things, and the economy will kind of move along without not too much catastrophe. But the dues that people pay in their lives for doing these jobs does not allow them the time, the energy, the opportunity to participate in things they would like to see changed. They just don't know what to do about it. And when you see the development of the human being as they grow up, and once, you know, when you're 16, 17, you hear things like this, your parents say, you'll see, you'll find out. And when you do, you fall into this hole, but you have to, because you have to survive and you have to be part of the machine going from the original point. They came in and they can do whatever they want. They have the money, it's like when the French came into Morocco. They came in and took over Morocco, And all of a sudden, all the Moroccans said, Ashkar Mara, Frances, which means, oh man, now we have to learn French. These terms, when I'm going the downturn, when you look at that language that's come out of here the last 6-8 months, and I left out a half a dozen. The subprime. What language is this? The TARP. What are they telling us? What are they filling our heads with? And because they're filling our heads with these guys, as you as a town planner one, you're out there in Coney Island talking to people, and these guys are walking over you. They're walking over us. And with a group that I worked with, every so often we get the smallest victory. We feel good for about 3 days. Everything else is too much to handle. They're too big.
Well, you know, it's not just happening on Lower East Side, and it's not just happening in the West Village. It's not just happening in Coney Island, and it's not just happening in Puerto Rico. It's a worldwide movement to displace people and or at least to squeeze more money out of them. And it's part of America. It's happening in New Orleans.
They took a picture of Gandhi's personal possessions at the time of his killing. A pair of glasses, a robe, sandals, and maybe a water jar. That was it. I feel the same way most of the time. I'm free of those toilsome burdens. Free of my tiresome diaries. Free of my kitchen cabinet with its ancient hippie tea from 1969. But I can't help it. I miss my ironing board and the letters you used to send me after we were beaten in Selma.
That was Ed Sanders, who may be calling us a little later this morning. And it's it's an opera about the destruction and the rebuilding, the many destructions and rebuildings of New Orleans, going from, the War of 1812 and before. That kind of thing happens a lot in this country, and there's always someone who's making a buck, and there's always somebody who's being squashed or crushed in the doing of it. You build a Washington Monument, you have slaves who build it. You have a library. There are some people that aren't allowed in. They go to sit down on a hot day, and they get moved along. People come and sniff them, and if they haven't bathed properly, well, forget it.
I got a wonderful poem from a guy, beautiful poem about New York, and I was so happy when he sent it to me because it made me really feel good. He said, "We've been through such a trauma since Bush, and all these unnecessary wars." And he even talks about going into Afghanistan was complete foolishness, because he said Alexander went into Afghanistan and he ran. Then the Persians went into Afghanistan and they ran. Then the British went into Afghanistan and they ran. Then the Russians came in and they ran. And he said, "We should start running now." And it gave this whole rap how they subverted culturally our mind with the city by the culture and the wars and Bush of the last 8 years. And he's asking us to return, not so much to return to those days of yesteryear, but that New York with all the terrible things like we're discussing here. It's still our city, has the kind of beauty and compassion and wonderfulness that we recognize that's been covered over by this dark cloud that's been around for the last 8 years. And this whole poem this guy wrote was about reclaiming the city any way you can, the best way you can. And you know, and not spending that much time how hellish it is, and it's hellish. When I see 11 businesses in my neighborhood in the last 2-3 years closed down, the bread store, the health food store, the Chinese takeout, the vegetable store, you know, the little hardware store where I've been buying stuff there for 30 years, the bread store, you know, and all of a sudden they become these useless places. One little place that's maybe 200 square feet sells dresses for $1,100 and up. Before that, this old Margaret sold vegetables, gave all the kids in the neighborhood an extra apple. Now, I don't want to really, you know, be nostalgic here, but with this guy's poem, it made me really feel good about my city after feeling like pushed over.
But this, I mean, these changes are not really, you know, everyone thinks of them as if they're accidental. This is just the way things are. These businesses just go out of business because if they were providing something for people, they wouldn't go out of business. But in fact, these are the result of very deliberate policies. I mean, if you are providing subsidies for developers to develop, well, someone's going to get displaced. And if you are not putting in place ground rules so that the negotiations between these tenants, so that tenants can invest in their businesses on the long term, so they can have that security and be able to secure their customer base, and you allow a landlord to just, you know, lay terms that are beneficial to him or to her, then you know, that's really no way. And that's just looking at it in the micro level. If you look at it in terms of larger scale developments, look at Fulton Mall, look at Albee Square. I mean, that's a place that had, you know, dozens of small businesses that the community, the African American community, had been going to for generations. The city decided that was not the highest and best use for the area. I mean, this was the third most profitable commercial district in the entire city. And what happened? Well, the lease was sold to this other developer. They got an upzoning. The guy sold that lease to another one. Mind you, this is on public property. So the city was party to that lease. Sold to another guy, and everyone was displaced. And what's there now? A hole in the ground. Nothing. Where there were all these businesses, where there was this place of the community. This is a place that was very important culturally for the community area. And now there's a hole in the ground. One developer made out with $100 million, and the other one is sitting on it because it's not really convenient for him or for them to make good on the terms of their agreement. And the contract that the city extended to them did not really have any provisions to, you know, exact any punitive measures from them.
Who are these people?
You want names?
Sure.
Thor Equities it went from Forest City Radnor to Thor Equities. Thor Equities, incidentally, being that the landowner who is right now blighting all of Coney Island or half of Coney Island. He's a speculator who everyone treats him. Not everyone, but you hear in the city often. Well, you know, or. From certain elected officials, you hear, well, at least he took a chance on Coney Island. Well, you know, if I knew that they were going to rezone from an amusement area to build higher and to make the land more valuable, that doesn't really take much of a leap of faith or much of a gamble to just get in there, buy the land, and just sit in it and wait. And what has happened since then is, well, he evicted Astroland, the longest standing amusement park in Coney Island. Well, going back to the other story, he was the guy who bought the lease in Albee Square. He got the upzoning. He sold it to, I believe it was, Acadia Realties. And then he made off with $100 million that he's now using as his war chest against the city in the rezoning war in Coney Island. And the other guy is just, sitting on a hole in the ground until,
but it's okay. See, it's capitalism and it's okay. See, that's okay for whom? Look, capitalism, if it's not broken, break it. And they have to keep doing this. Now, the people, when you talk to people about this is going on.
You said once there's nothing wrong with capitalism except the side effects.
Yeah, capitalism has too many side effects.
Yeah.
And I'm talking deep stuff here. I mean, it makes people sick. It kills people. Capitalism is torture. It is a form of torture. You don't have to go into...
Speaking of forms of torture, this is WBAI in New York City, and we are also broadcasting on KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, which is not too far from Homer, Alaska, and we might talk a little bit more about that and the Iditarod later today.
You made a good point before
I have another statement. CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, which is began as a colony of American expatriates who were making a very definite statement about not supporting the Vietnam War. That's CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. They're listening with us now, as in one half hour, less than a half hour, we'll be joined by Tom Paine's friend, Liberty, in WJFF in Liberty, Grahamsville, and Jeffersonville, New York. That's in the Catskills, which are practically being washed away at this moment. With all this rain, they're going to raise the water tax. If you buy your water from for your own house, you're going to find your water bill is higher this year. Not because of the rain, but in spite of it. So I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, he made this important point before when he said, when he talks to people about change, they usually would say, things change. Yeah. Right?
Right.
Okay. But you're saying, look how it changes. Now, before, when I say follow the bouncing coin, it's always about that, to keep it stabilized. Has to be a certain amount of people working and paying taxes and paying for all the things in the city for this thing to move on. People in some way know who's moving this stuff around. Why all of a sudden there's this 22-story condo building across the street. You know, and the hammering that goes on for a year and a half, and how you can't walk down the street and how terrible it is. They know where that's coming from, but they go, hey, that's the way it is. And as long as we believe that, that will stay that. Now, I'm an artist. I'm an activist. I'm an artist. As long as we can keep something else alive, then that's something else, right? And that something else is to help people discover that things just don't move by chance. Change just doesn't change, you know. Good change comes out of struggle when enough people wake up from the bottom up and they improve their lives. That other change that's going on all the time is what you're talking about. People don't... Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that part of it is you talk about following the bouncing coin. Part of the trick is trying to figure that out, because that is not always so easy. I mean, it is very easy to come up with a simplistic answer, but for any one of these of these projects, every one of these things that you see, there is an obvious beneficiary, but how that all happened within the world of governance, who exactly is connected to whom, how these people were unable to stop, why is it that some people have are more effective in creating an opposition than others?
It shouldn't be so hard to figure out. It's happened in so many places. So many people have seen it. Orleans, St. Louis, Chicago, every place that people live, every place that buildings go up, there has been development that has been pushed. I mean, but pushed people aside, like the Okies are pushed aside in Steinbeck's novel. I want to say Gone with the Wind, Grapes of Wrath. You know, the way it doesn't matter. Your house, it's not your house anymore. It belongs to the bank, and then the bank is going to knock it over.
Well, I mean, I think if you look, you know, I don't want to sort of glamorizing places abroad, but I think that other places do pay a lot more attention to the cultural value that is associated with certain places. And that's not really something that you necessarily see here. I mean, one of the things that happen in Coney Island, you see it not just in Coney Island, you see it throughout when people care about a place, is that you'll get the people who are pushing the development pay lip service and say, well, you know, we know that this place is very valuable, and it's so near and dear to so many people, and that's why we want to do this project this way. And what they present you with bears no relation at all to the reason that people value it or the use that people give it. And I don't think that is the same elsewhere. I think that is a very local tendency. In the case of Coney Island, you've seen people, and I don't even want to question their intentions. It may be that they want to do something that honors that history. It may be that they want to do something that works for people. But when they try to figure out what that will be, other than relying on this idea that, well, we want the place to be vibrant and unique and zany. Well, how do you operationalize those terms? How do you make that into something new and something that works? Well, they haven't really figured that out here. I know this is a radio show, but I brought a little illustration. And what's interesting about this illustration is that right now we are going – this is actually for the benefit of people who are not seeing this.
Do you have this stuff on a website?
Yeah. It's SaveConeyIsland.net. And it's right there on the front page. There's a picture of the way the skyline of Coney Island is now. You have this wonderful open-air seaside amusement area,
little,
right?
A little like Paris, cobble roof, although Paris is probably not like that anymore either.
And so right now this project is going through a public review process, and the city is telling us that, or is telling, you know, everyone, that it would be a very good idea to put 27-story hotels on lining Surf Avenue, which is that big avenue that forms the boundary of the amusement area, essentially creating a wall between Coney Island. What's interesting is that even though this is the public review process, the city has not seen fit to produce a rendering showing people what this will look like.
It's a monolith that looks like something, you know, for the people from outer space to
right.
see, well, to tell them.
Well, what they show you is this.
No further.
What they show you is like conceptual, a conceptual colored drawing with, revelers having a great time basking in the sun. Mm-hmm. They don't show you this. This we had to do ourselves because the city was not really producing it.
I don't see any revelers in that. But
I've been
2001.
I've been commenting on this for many, many years. I saw it coming. Ezra Pound said that the artist was the antennae of the race. I don't know if that's 100% true, but it kind of makes sense to me. And I saw this happening many years ago. I saw it first when, in my neighborhood, where artists were living in cheap lofts and were fixing them and carrying carrying bathtubs up four flights of stairs and sending away to Life magazine how to install a bathtub, and had different jobs so they can make their art, their poetry, whatever they were making. They built these beautiful lofts, and a few people moved in, and they made these beautiful lofts. And they were so affordable. And then all of a sudden, somebody from the New York Times magazine starts photographing these lofts. And all of a sudden, people, gee, look at these lofts. We'd love to live there.
Yeah, we'd like to live like artists, even if we're
stockbrokers. And all of a sudden, people start buying these buildings. And since most of these people weren't protected by the new loft laws, they were kicked out. I remember, you know, John Gibson, he was in one of those lawyers. He plays with Philip Glass, a great clarinet player. One day he gets a knock on his door. He's got this, lives in a five-story loft building. Very cheap back then. Guy knocks on the door, and he says, I'm your new landlord, and I will give you $50,000. This is years ago, $50,000, a lot of money, more money than it is now. I'll give you $50,000 to move, and I'll give you 6 months to move. Or you can go to court and get nothing. Okay?
I guess I won't ask what he did.
Huh? And this was a guy who bought the building, and John had lived there, raising his children there for years, and all of a sudden, John calls up his lawyer, and he says, yeah, man, if you go to court, you'll get nothing. So with all the stuff that he built there.
Except if we go to court, the lawyer said, you'll have to pay me $50,000.
So I saw this many years ago, but also been watching whatever resistance there is to this. Michael McKee from Tenants and Neighbors, you know him? Mm-hmm. I think he does great work here in the city. And there's some people that I've met who, you know, up in the Bronx and in Harlem doing great things in the city. We're not a unified group, or else we'd be out in the street 200,000 strong next Tuesday telling the Rent Guidelines Board that we don't want any raise in the percentage for new leases. Now, 200,000 people went in the street, we'd get that.
Right.
It's the same mechanism why people in Coney Island would love to be part of a decision-making team. What's the best thing for my community? You know,
right, and part of the challenge is also the kind of, you know, trying to figure out what that is. If you're given information, you're in the city, telling you, well, you know, look, jobs, affordability, and you believe that information.
Yeah, what's the rap?
Well, you know, then of course you're gonna, that's what you're gonna go with. But you know, I don't think that a very good job is done looking back at what the city predicted they were going to be producing in terms of jobs for every one of these projects. You know, go back to see what was this Albee Square that we were just talking about. How many jobs was that supposed to create? You know, how many services were those? What was that highest and better use supposed to be where there is now a hole in the ground?
Doesn't matter.
The batting rate is not very good.
Doesn't matter. Whatever they're going to tell you, that's just their rap. Sure. They're going to go and do it. And they're going to make money.
Well, it is just their rap, except that they have people employed full-time going out to the community and selling this rap.
Of course. Their line is,
right,
we'll work with the community.
Right, right.
I've heard that at so many.
You know, what's interesting is that the city boasts about all these. They had dozens of these community meetings, and they did. You know, who the relevant community of a project that is of citywide importance is, is it's different question, but they did go out there and they did have these public community meetings, and they came up with this plan. What is interesting is, one, they did that, and just a short time later, they completely changed that plan. That's the plan, the part that they don't tell you, that the plan that they ended up with, the plan that they're voting on, that the Planning Commission rubber-stamped yesterday, and the plan that the City Council is going to be voting on, is very different from the plan that is the product of these of this supposed community process.
These developers have 7-8 guys on their team, and they're very well versed and very articulate in their role. So I went to a meeting, and a guy gets up and says, "Hi, everybody. I'm from the Morgan Group. We're building a 21-story luxury hotel on Crosby Street between Grand and Broome Street. We're going to have a 5-star chef from France." Now, in the audience is about 60 people. who live on Broome Street, who don't, and you know they've already lost.
Right.
You hear in the audience, now we like to bring up our acoustic representative, who's going to show you the amount of that will be coming out of the three different places where we have to have music, including the outdoor cafe, where we're building this special wall that sound what. Now, here's the impact statement by this guy. They're all very rehearsed, and we're sitting here going, oh, God, what do I have to do to get out of this movie?
Right.
And every time I go there, when I walk out, yeah. Every time I walk out, I go, help, help. And I just, I'm an artist in America. I'm an aware, I'm an activist. The thing is so big, I'm trying to find my thing in it.
In the event of something happening to me, there is something I'd like you all to see. It's just a photograph of someone that I knew. A photograph of someone that I knew. I keep straining my ears to hear a sound. Maybe someone is digging underground. Or have they given up and all gone home to bed? Thinking those who once existed must be dead. Have you seen your wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide, Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones. Event of something happening to me, there is something I'd like you all to see. It's just a photograph of someone that I knew. A photograph of someone that I knew. Have you seen your wife, Mr. Jones?
Mr. Jones.
Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide. Mr. Jones, Mr. Jones, Mr. Jones. Maybe someone is digging underground.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what happened. It suddenly, calm down, Laurie. Calm down, Laurie Lieberson. Suddenly, the speakers just died in this room, and it looked like we weren't on the air. And Bill was listening on the air, and we weren't on the air. I don't know what happened in your neck of the woods, but just before that, one of our CD players had gobbled up a CD, won't give it back, and things are deteriorating around here at WBAI, and the solution to all of these problems has dollar sign in front of it. If you contribute to WBAI, maybe we can find some way to rise above the muck of Wall Street. You know, we were a pretty, you know, reasonably healthy station until we came down here. Everything was going pretty well until that naughty airplane flew into the Trade Center, and then everybody around here got a little crazy for a year or two. We were in the middle of a coup, and we had people coughing up blood. People who were coming to work carrying, our usual equipment and going through muck to... I carried muck home from that disaster, going through the water that was flowing with the ashes and the cinders of the people who died in that catastrophe, not to mention all of the rats that died and all of the other life forms. And the water in the air was pretty toxic. There were grains of glass and all kinds of chemicals in the air. And we breathed it in and out, and we continued in the middle of our own craziness and our own battles toward, protecting your right to listen to the radio. We kept on and struggled, and some people sickened and died on the staff. And you ought to support a group of people who are that dedicated, don't you think? you know, you can go to our website at WBAI.org and make a contribution there now. If you make a contribution of $25, you will become a member, which will entitle you to vote in our the elections that we have to elect the people who make the decisions. The board of directors, which is there to give advice and cautions to the people who were going crazy trying to run a radio station. Occasionally we have bloody battles about that. We're in the midst, I believe, of a kind of a minor brouhaha that we might talk about, might not talk about. But the important news, the exciting news, is that in just 1 minute, less than 1 minute, Liberty will introduce WBAI. Liberty does a program in Liberty, New York on WJFF that's mostly directed at shut-ins in the prisons of Sullivan County. And she does great work, and we're privileged to be following her. And if there are people in the audience who carry over from her show to this, I'm happy to welcome you. This is WBAI in New York City, KWMD in Casilla, Alaska, WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York, and we are streaming on the World Wide Web. We can be heard coast to coast around the world, and those of you who are in the New York environs, a very few of you, actually, because it's a tiny theater, will have the privilege of seeing Steve Ben Israel in his one-man show, which will be at the Theater Lab in their extraordinary performance series. Steve Ben Israel, Sunday, June 26th, 27th, 28th. That's Friday through Sunday. And it's at the Theater Lab, 137 West 14th Street. And Steve Ben Israel is here with us this morning. And
it's nice that Juan is here also, because Juan is a town planner, and he's doing similar work that we're all doing. We're trying to... Julian Beck used to say, when the people find out they're not stupid, changes will come faster than we think. So there's one there in Coney Island trying to explain to the people that this change that is coming to this historic wonder called Coney Island. And if you ever see that documentary on the history of Coney Island, have you seen it? It's extraordinary, going back 100 years. And talking to the people there trying to salvage their Coney Island, or the what we know as the historical Coney Island, and the developers coming in and just rolling over them, he's trying to explain to people that it's not that things change. There's a motivation here that is really nasty, that is anti-culture, that is anti-human. You know, Bob, when you were talking about being down here on Wall Street after September 11th, not only was there the death of all those innocent people, but there was death in the culture times 10.
Yeah.
And death, the way it came apart.
Death by, commercialized terror.
Exactly. The object is to rob death of its power. Death is this power that is just moving around the world. The most used word in the 21st century, this is the 21st century, right?
I think so.
In the 21st century is the word terror. It's been so used, so overused. said so many different ways. But the object of robbing death from its power. And Bob, we've been talking about this 50 years, the resistance that we represent. And the resistance that we represent, you know, we've learned a lot about all the other resistances over the last 50-100 years. And we've had to learn it not in school. They didn't teach you this in school. Because the dates of the wars are burned into our brains, and the people's struggle for peace is stashed under the royal historian's robes, or where the gold is hidden. So we've had to dig up all the stories of resistance of the last 100 years or so and see, you know, what people have done. And we have that cataloged. We have a laundry list, if you prefer. And I remember in the early 80s when I was working with Teamsters for a Democratic Union and the IWW, when we did a cultural event up at the Queens Democratic Club in Astoria, and it was a cultural night. There was me doing 15, 20 minutes of humor, Larry Estridge doing folk music, Sam Dolgoff from the IWW, who said there's a lot of unions but very little unionism, and Rose Cohn, who was in the Patterson strike of 1913. Now, Rose was born in 1895, so in 1913 she was like, I don't know, 18, 19, and she was part of the organizers that one day all the textile workers went on strike across America, and 2 weeks later, bong, the 8-hour day. And she spoke to these Teamsters about this. What we did, she said, to make this happen took years and years of organizing. We did a play at the Madison Square Garden called The Pageant of the Patterson Textile Workers. And she gave this great rap to all these big, heavy Teamsters. She was 89 then. She had shrunk down to like maybe 4'10", you know what I mean? But that was that cultural evening of Rose telling these Teamsters about how they organized the 8-hour day. And she says, and now you're working 8 and 12 again. 10 and 12 again. So this whole mysterious process of organizing people.
What is challenging, of course, is that when you're talking about cities, it takes years for this resistance to happen. But when you're dealing with decisions about the built environment, that mistake is going to stay there for a very long time. You look at Penn Station, people are still lamenting 40 years after the fact. And they can still not rectify that civic tragedy. Not only that, but they're doing it again and again, and they're about to do it again in Coney Island. So not only do they not learn from their mistakes, but these mistakes are mistakes that are with us for a long time and that we live to regret. Why? I think it is unfortunate that the people who are responsible for these mistakes are not associated with them, so that the legacy of this civic devastation is not linked to their names in infamy.
Hello, Robert Moses. Do you want to go back?
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be the big one. And actually, that's interesting that you mentioned Robert Moses, because what's happened in Coney Island now, in a sense, is something that has been. It dates way back. Robert Moses, he thought that there was no place in New York for outdoor recreations, that this was a thing of the past, this was honky-tonk, this was not a contemplative place like Jones Beach. And so he wanted to turn that into a residential neighborhood, and he had the tool at his disposal to do it, Title I, Urban Renewal. And so he declared large swaths of Coney Island blighted. This became a boon for people who would just buy the property, sit on it, and then sell it to the government. And then these high-rises were built. And that, within 5 years, tripled the population of Coney Island, completely changed the political dynamic of the place. So from going to a low-density place where people just went for recreation, this place with bungalows and whatnot, it became a residential neighborhood with all the attendant concerns of a residential neighborhood. And that's great, but what has slowly happened is that the importance of the citywide function that Coney Island plays, a regional function that Coney Island plays, has slowly, if not been forgotten, it has been almost an afterthought. And even though you hear the city saying that that's not the case, the plan speaks for itself. The amusement area is a small sliver of what used to be under their plans.
You mentioned Astroland before, and just more recently you mentioned Penn Station. That brings to mind the establishment of the Landmarks Commission, and I think it was the Penn Station
debacle
that caused that. And Astroland, I'm thinking other places, other sites in Coney Island and elsewhere. Is landmarking any kind of a defensive strategy to help prevent what you're trying to document?
There are several sites landmarked in Coney Island. The Cyclone is, the Parachute Jump is, and the Wonder Wheel is as well. The problem with landmarking is that landmarking only protects physical structures, the outside of physical structures. And what is important about Coney Island, there is some built environment that is worth preserving and that is certainly threatened by what the city is proposing. All those enormous buildings that I showed you would be on the sites where you now have Nathan's, where you have buildings dating back over 100 years. The Henderson Building, which is a building where Groucho Marx first performed in the city. But what is important about Coney Island beyond that is this history of outdoor recreation. It's the function to which it has been put. And if you compromise that, you may call it Coney Island. The city may think that it still is revitalizing it and turning it into a tourist attraction. But if you've developed it in a way that completely dissociates it from that history, you might as well just, you know, be off some exit in Jersey, because it's really not going to be a place of Brooklyn. It's not going to be the Coney Island people have, grown up with.
What you're saying, you're destroying its context.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a. Actually, this is kind of interesting. You guys might enjoy this. So we put up this petition online, and before starting our petition drive, and the online petition before very long started getting hundreds of signatures, now thousands, from people all over the world, Japan, Australia, all kinds of people talking about or upset about what is happening in Coney Island, and they give you this little space where you can put in a personal comment about why it is that you're signing this petition, and here's a couple that I found. These are representative of the kind of stuff that people were putting in. My mom still has a picture of herself and her date at the time in 1953 on her shelf in Springfield, Massachusetts, to recall a time that brought her only the excitement that Coney could bring. Have we as people really come to only valuing place for its monetary redevelopment? Have we forgotten the importance of play? Deborah Basile, Holyoke, Massachusetts. And here's another one that I like. I live in Oregon, but have visited Coney Island twice in my many visits to New York City. To me, a day at Coney Island was at the top of my list of things to do when I visited New York City in the late 70s. I love the place, and it's very painful to keep reading about it being slowly but surely downsized. Why not make it a permanent amusement zone and realize what a fantastic draw it is to people all over the world? Evan Kramer, Port Orford, Oregon. And like that, there are hundreds of people
cry out to be rated to some record.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the History Project, actually, right by the Cyclone, does something more or less along those lines. But trying to marshal these people, particularly when these are people who might care about the place, but who they don't vote in the city. These are people from all over the place. Try to have those voices be to respond to those voices in the formulation of a plan is a challenge, and it's not a challenge that the city, I think, is taking seriously.
Government. Developers and government, I heard, have been in cahoots for a few thousand years. And every so often, you may go through the city council or somebody who's progressive in government and may get a little bit of help. You had that experience?
Yeah, I mean, there are some people who have been very supportive.
It's amazing. Every so often you find one.
like Bernie Sanders, the socialist, who's the governor, senator from Vermont. Mm-hmm. Except for those people and what we're up against, it is so difficult. When you show me that picture, as Bob describes, what do you describe it as?
It looked like that monolith in 2001 that comes down and amazes the cave people.
The people in that building, in that picture, have to have a lot of money, a great deal of money. They're going to have to build something for those people and not for the other people.
You know what's funny about these buildings is that they're hotels.
Of course the hotels.
And the question is, who's going to stay in those hotels? If you ruin the appeal of the very reason why people would want to go there, who on earth is going to stay there?
Rich people can go for the myth of it and take a quick look and go somewhere else.
Mm.
Doesn't matter. As long as you can use Coney Island. Mm. You know, that's what will happen.
Is there another Jackie Onassis around?
Well,
we worked up another of William Blake's greatest poems. We can only do part of it. It's written about 1800. It's the poem beginning to see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wildflower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. It's called The Auguries of Innocence, and we've tied it into a complaint of our own. In your own. To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wildflower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. Robin Redbreast in a cage puts all of heaven in a rage. A dove house filled with doves and pigeons shudders hell through all its regions. Homeless, 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 homeless. A dog starved at his master's gate predicts the ruin of the state. A horse misused upon the road to heaven for human blood. Each outcry of the hunted hare, a fiber from the brain does tear. A skylark wounded in the wing, a cherubim does cease to sing. Homeless, 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 homeless. The man asleep on the subway grate dreams the doom of the warrior state. She who weeps in a cardboard cart calls an Wall Street heart. The Reagan administration cut its federal housing assistance from $33 billion in 1981 to $8 billion in 88. And some of that was for golf courses. Homeless, 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 homeless. The babe that weeps the rod beneath writes revenge in realms of death. The beggar's rags fluttering in air
dust to rags the heavens tear. The soldier armed with sword and gun, palsied strikes the summer sun. One mite wrung from the laborer's hands shall buy and sell the miser's lands. Homeless, 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 homeless. Every night and every morn, some to misery are born. Every morn and every night, some are born to sweet delight. God appears and God is light to those poor souls who dwell in night. But does a human form display to those who dwell in realms of day? To those who dwell in realms of day.
It isn't very well known that the same month that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, this other even more important find was stumbled upon hard by Masada by one of the Israeli archaeologists working in Cave 63. Lunchtime. Chaim Plutznik eating, has to relieve himself. He goes next door to Cave 64, tinkles. Why is a glint on the floor of the cave? He bends down and looks. Eureka! Another copper ruggler, an old rolled-up copper plate. It was the first national anthem. Mel Brooks deciphers the first line, but then difficulties. They take it to the Harvard universe. And here, now at last, after many years of scholarly hoarding and fistfights, the entire canticle, and by the way, it was carbon dated to January 12th, 2 p.m., 4004 B.C., a very fucking date. This is the hymn to nationalism. And we want to dedicate this to the Armenians and Azeris, the Sikhs and Hindus, Ukrainians and Great Russians, Jews and Arabs, Hutu and Tutsi, Greeks and Turks, Romans and barbarians, etc., etc., and really too much etc. It's a hymn to nationalism. Let them all go to hell except Cave 64. If they give you any trouble, throw them through the door. This is a cave, it's the best in the world. We don't want no foreigners, no cave like it.
Esas tierras del rincón la sembra con un guaypando, se me reventó el barzón y sigue la yunta andando. Cuando llegue a media tierra, el arado iba enterrado. Se enterró hasta la telera, el timón se desofó, el yugo se iba panteando, el barzón iba rozando, el sembrador me iba hablando. Yo le dije al sembrador, no me hablé cuando andé arando. Se me reventó el barzón y sigue la yunta andando. Cuando acabé de piscar, vino el rico y lo partió. Todo mi maíz se llevó, ni para comer me dejó. Me presenta aquí la cuenta, aquí debes 20 pesos de tienda. Con todo el mes que te toca no le pagas a la hacienda, pero cuentas con mi tierra para seguirla sembrando. Ahora vete a trabajar pa' que sigas abonando. Nomás me quedé pensando, sacudiendo mi cobija, haciendo un cigarro de hoja, que patrón tan sinvergüenza. Soy más se llevó para su maldita troje. Se me reventó el barzón y sigue la yunta andando. Cuando llegué a mi casita, me decía mi prenda amada, ¿dónde el maíz que te tocó? Le respondí yo mi triste, el patrón se lo llevó, por lo que debía en la hacienda, pero me dijo el patrón que contara con la tienda. Ahora voy a trabajar para seguirle abonando. 20 pesos 10 centavos son los que salgo restando, me decía mi prenda amada, ya no trabas con ese hombre, no me lo está robando, anda al salón de sesiones, que te lleve mi compadre, y no le hagas caso al padre, él hizo sus comuniones, que no ves a tu familia, que ya no tiene calzones, yo tengo ya faldilla, ni tienes pantalones. Nomás me quedé pensando, porque dejé a mi patrón, me decía mi prenda amada, que vaya el patrón al cuerno, como estuviéramos de hambre, si te has seguido creyendo, de lo que te decía el cura de las penas del infierno. Viva la revolución, muera el supremo gobierno, se me reventó el barzón, y siempre te quise.
We should say a few words about the Mermaid Parade, which is, I hope it's not the last Mermaid Parade.
No, it's not. It's not.
But it's a celebration of what the freakiness and the wonderfulness of Coney Island.
Right. No, the Mer Parade, this is not going to be the last one. The Mer Parade is still going to be happening And it's not just the Mermaid Parade, this misconception that's going around that Coney Island has shut down, and it's not the case. The Cyclone is still there, the Wonder Wheel is still there, and there's this wonderful skating rink, actually. This is actually a great story from that involves a friend of mine, the reason why I actually ended up getting involved with Coney Island to begin with. She's an artist, and she's from Michigan, and she came to Coney Island once, and she just fell in love with the place. And she said, "I want to open a store on the boardwalk." And she started making these designs and making T-shirts out of them and making other different things. And she opened a tiny little store on the boardwalk, and she made a go of it. And she did well. And she started wholesaling these Coney Island inspired products. And she opened a market there in Union Square. And then she started supplying it to bigger stores. And she was one of the victims, along with Astroland, of the land speculation that the city involvement unleashed. But throughout all this, she starts saying, "I want to open a skating rink." And I'm thinking, you know, you're about to get evicted from your store, and you're talking about opening a skating rink here in what building, where, with what, and you know, who's going to pay for all this? Well, she entered this contest, Make Your Dream Come True. I think it was sponsored by Tommy Hilfiger and Glamour Magazine or something like that, and she won it. And so that gave her the seed money to open this skating rink. So now all she needed was, other than paying for the insurance, which is quite a bit, she needed a building. As luck would have it, at the end of the boardwalk, not the very end, but the end of the boardwalk within the amusement district, there is the historic old Child's Restaurant, which is this it's this like stuccoed maritime themed building that was being used for nothing, for storage, by this one of the developers that had bought some of that land to well, that cannot be torn down, but the rest of it was going
to
be.
I went to Child's once with my mother.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. She had, I don't know, tea or something in the middle of the afternoon. And I was about, I don't know, 10 or 11. I had a T-shirt on. And the waiter brought me a jacket. So they had these waiter's jackets. They made me wear one so that I would be properly dressed for this elegant dining room. And, of course, the jacket smelled of kerosene.
Right.
But that was the elegance of Coney Island.
Well, now when you go there at night, what you see is, and it's quite surreal because it's all dark because there's no development between the stadium and this building. And you're approaching and you see this pink light glowing out of this building and pulsating disco music. Mm. And there are these themed roller skating nights, and it's incredible. And she made this happen, and it's really fantastic.
What's her name?
Diana Carlin, of also known as Lola Star. She owns the Lola Star Boutique, and this is the Dreamland skating rink, which is that is not something that may be going on next season, depending on what happens at Coney Island. But the Mermaid Parade is still going to happen, and it is this Saturday, and it should be fantastic. And we're really trying to make people aware during the parade. This is a big opportunity for us to make people aware of what the city is trying to do and the problems that Coney Island is facing, to see if we can get them involved.
Oh, speaking of going through some trouble to make people aware, this is WBAI in New York City. And we're also broadcasting on KWMD in Conseil of Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty. And we are streaming on the World Wide Web. And someone has something they'd like to add to this morning. Shall we give them a chance? Yes, you're on the radio.
Hello?
Yes, you're on
Hello?
The radio.
Yeah, can you tell me the name of the last song you play, Mexican song?
Yes, it's El Barzón.
What?
El?
Yes.
Barzón. Let me see. I'll spell it. It's wait a minute now. Can you translate it?
Yes.
Oh, would you? Would you?
No. The name of El Danzón.
No, Barzón. B-A-R.
Barzón.
Barzón. I think it's. Barzón. I think it's like a yoke that goes around the neck of an oxen or a mule.
Uh-huh. Where I can get this CD? Do you know?
Where can you get it?
Yes.
Well, I got it from the internet.
Ah.
So, okay. And I don't know. I don't know whether. I mean, I guess you can put Il Bars. Do you ever use the internet? What is your name, by the way?
Estella.
Yes. Do you use the internet?
Yes.
Well, do you download music?
No.
Well, maybe you have a friend.
I can try.
Okay. Well, it's Ochoa. So
what? Ochoa.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And okay. It's Il Barzón.
Il Barzón.
Amparo Ochoa.
Amparo?
Yeah.
Ochila.
Ochoa.
Ochoa.
Ah, Ochoa. Okay.
I'm glad.
Do you understand what she said?
I had someone translate it for me. It's very it's very intricate, and it's a great performance. I'm glad you liked it.
But I love. Yeah. I understand because I speak Spanish.
Well, you understand it. Would you tell us?
Yeah.
Translate it,
please. She says that she rents a piece of land, and all the charge the landlord gave to her. You pay for the grocery, you pay for the corn, you pay for all these things. In the end, she doesn't have anything, and even her dog, something like this, she said. And it's like I broke the cane and start again, because every time the landlord comes, said, okay, you don't pay the in the grocery, but you pay me the rent. You continue to use the land and pay for the rent.
Right, and you continue to breathe. You breathe my air, the landlord says.
Yeah, but it's in my country. I am from Argentina. I met somebody who, when he came to my city, he knew for the first time the money, because he worked in a big farm, and the landlord paid with bonus, and the grocery was inside the farm. So everybody need to buy in his grocery. So he never have money. He never received money in exchange for his job. He escaped and he arrived to my city. I don't know how. And he knew the value of the money when he came to my city. I started to do different job, but he said that they were punished by Capanga. Capanga is in Argentina. The guy like the slavery time who control the people.
The overseer. The overseer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what she said in her song is that the people work the land. Always, they don't know to read and write, so always the landlord adds, you owe me this, you owe me that,
yeah.
But they don't know how much money they own, because they don't know to read and write. Exactly. More or less what she said in her song, that all the time the landlord show up, say, oh, you owe me this, you owe me that, you owe me this, but she never know if it's true or not.
Yeah, there are songs like that in English too. You know, I owe owe my soul to the company store.
I want more. Give me more.
Right.
Yeah.
I think.
And in the old time in Argentina, the gaucho, the cowboys, was the same story. The pulperia where the place where they went to drink, and the owner of the bar. They always said, you owe me more, this 12 beer, 12 wine, and they never knew it was true or not, because they didn't know to read and write. So what she said is that, the exploitation of the landlord. That is the story of the song. I like.
She's talking about the way it really is.
Exactly, that. Exploitation of the landlord with the poor people.
I thank you for calling. That's wonderful.
You're welcome. Put again, play again, because I love this song. Okay.
I might do that. Yeah, I might do that.
Okay. Good night.
I'm going to answer a few more calls. Then.
Okay. Right. Bye. Good night.
You're on the air.
Yeah. Hello.
Hello.
It's me. It's Tom from the Bronx.
Hiya, Tom.
Yeah. I have this to say that Coney Island, unfortunately, like a lot of the areas in New York City, are changing into real commercial zones. I mean, for housing and all.
You talk to me sometimes about science, you know, and you talk about enzymes, right?
Yeah.
What is an enzyme?
Enzymes.
An enzyme is something that changes something else and doesn't change itself.
Well,
the enzyme is the landlord in this case.
Well, I mean...
The landlord.
All right. Well, oh, yeah. Well, I was going to try to answer that. But what I'm getting at is that it's we're part of the passing parade. Remember that old TV show? Well, it was in the movies originally, and they brought it to TV. All these areas were commercially, people didn't want to live near the ocean. Am I right? Years ago, the ocean, if you live near the ocean, it was the cheapest place to live. Am I right or wrong?
Well, not now.
No, I mean, but I mean, before electricity and all, wasn't the ocean the cheapest place you could live?
I you know, I'm
or near
old.
The ocean.
I'm pretty old, but I don't remember the days before.
Well, the ocean front. I mean, yeah. I mean, ocean proper, because it was always subject to storms and all. So if you live near the ocean, a lot of people didn't want to live near the ocean. And Coney Island, when you go back in history, was called Looney Island. It had the name Looney for a while. And it was a place where the pirates of old used to bury their treasure, too, in Coney Island. I read that.
The original name of Coney Island, you know, was Narioch. It was Canarsie Indians named it, and it was it meant the land without shadows because it was all covered with dunes. And the current name is from rabbits. The Dutch gave it that. Who were the rabbits that inhabited those dunes? And of course, it had many other names since then, like Sodom by the Sea and
Luna Park,
Paradise of the Proletariat, and Poor Man's Riviera, and a whole bunch of others. Some flattering, some less so.
You're in the air.
Yeah, it's me again. I just have this to add. One time it was called Looney Island too for a while. And in other words, I think the sailors gave it that name, Looney Island.
Thank you. And you're on the air. He thought that they were calling him when he said Looney Island. You're on the radio.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have been doing research on the city of Portland for the last several weeks, and when your guest mentioned that he lived in Oregon, my ears perked up. So, sir, what city in Oregon do you live?
He doesn't live in Oregon.
Oh, I thought he said he lived in Oregon.
No, you had something else in your ears, George. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Good morning.
I'd like to speak of another place.
Would you
on the ocean.
Would you turn your radio down, please?
Yes, if you hold just a second, I'll do that.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah, I think that's off now.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I was going to say another place parallel to Coney Island that is disappearing is Rockaway Beach. And the reason I bring this to attention of your very fine guest, especially speaks of the city evil plans and things, there still is a large part of more than 2 miles of Rockaway Beach that's in the people's hands that is running from Beach 74th Street, if you want to know, to Beach 32nd Street, more than 2 miles along the ocean.
We'll fight them on the beaches. We'll fight them in...
Well, that 2 miles is in process of being gifted to land thieves, to embezzlement artists. And Giuliani had a lot to do with this, and Bloomberg is following through. You know, the Bloomberg who came in worth $6 or $7 billion and is now $22 or $23 billion. People ought to turn some attention to what was perhaps not quite Coney Island, but there was a place called Playland in the Rockaways.
Right.
The Rockaways, this 2 mile stretch along the ocean, still has 4 subway stations ready to deliver the 8 million owners of this oceanfront to their perhaps summer pleasures, a couple of weekends during the coming months. People who don't necessarily have summer cottages out in the Hamptons or up in the Catskills or other such places. Without cars and new roadways, existing subway stations, this land is in process of being ripped out of the public realm and literally gifted to land thieves. Not just the land, but some hundreds of millions out of the city treasury in cash as assistance to the land thieves in moving their plans forward. plans which include cheese box deposits, so-called houses, straight off the truck, you know, Lego-type things just pasted together, and which, under agreement, will not be paying for 20 years any city taxes. The surrender of public land, what could be playland and much more, or for that matter, the old Coney Island and much more. The lunar parks that people have mentioned, Meet Me Tonight in Dreamland, is it, and Steeplechase.
Right.
That could be Rockaway. It is a magical place, the interface between land and water for all people.
Yes. Edges are really always like that. They're always one
Well,
of
yes,
places.
Edges, but especially water edges, because we all spent maybe the happiest 9 months of our lives in salt water. I'll say goodnight to you, and I'd like to see more BAI interaction between the station and its listeners. I'll say goodnight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Be well.
So would I. And you're on the air.
More BAI interaction between the station.
Hello.
Hello. Turn your radio down, please.
Oh, sorry. I'm listening to on KWMD in Alaska on the interweb.
You are. Where are you?
Yeah.
Where are you?
I'm in Fairbanks, actually. Wait, let me take this earpiece out, because I was listening to you both ways.
Wow.
Yeah, I follow you guys just about every chance I get every couple of weeks. And I just wanted to say hello from the great state of Alaska. And where, I just wanted I wanted to wish you an Eiler Palarm, which is native for Komahabi, which means greetings and goodwill.
Thank you.
And I just want to say that I'm thoroughly enjoying your show.
Thank
I
you.
Wish that you would expand your horizons beyond, Rockaway Beach. I know you're New York-centric, but I really wish you would kind of expand a little bit more, maybe cover, Farfelotus of the Blowhole, the Michael Mara show, and my team. That would be great. Because
thank
I would.
Thank you. You're on the radio. You're on the radio.
Bob,
gotta go. Oh, you gotta go.
Yeah, I just give one.
That guy makes me feel like I want to.
Yeah, I just want to give this last shout out. I am Steve Ben Israel. My show is Nonviolent Executions, the 26th, 27th, 28th of June, at Theater Lab, 137 West 14th Street. Number there is 929-2545. And on the web, you can go to TheaterLab, one word, TheaterLabNYC.com, and there's the rest of the story. And Juan, it was wonderful meeting you, and, have this great rap about somebody who's doing this great work in Coney Island trying to save what's ever left. Like we said earlier, they come in, they demolish it, and you try to pick up the pieces, right?
We're trying, and if you're interested in finding out what you can do, go to SaveConeyIsland.net. All the information is there. We're going to be there in full force during the Mermaid Parade on Saturday. Please join us. We'll be handing out placards. We'll be leading a petition drive, and hopefully we'll make something happen. The City Council is going to vote on this in... Oh, a little bit over a month, so we don't have that much time to preserve Coney Island for future generations.
Thank you.
And you're on the air. This is a very, very dedicated schmuck. He's very, very dedicated.
Was the guy from Alaska?
What's that?
The guy from Alaska who asked?
No. He punked us.
Yeah.
Now, it would be great if somebody actually in Alaska called, a real person from Alaska. But doesn't seem to be what's happening. I think I understand the problem we've been having here tonight.
What was he asking?
And it's because of that damn delay system. which is on. I think that's the reason we've been having that problem. Well, I don't know what is wrong with the telephone. Oh, there he is again. I don't know what's wrong with him. You're on the radio. Huh. Oop. Could it be him again? Is it him? Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Can that guy from Coney Island say again what's happening in a month?
Can you come back? One, for just a moment, somebody wants one more question before you. Hi. This is one of our WJFF listeners.
No, that your guest. I was wondering if he could say what is happening in a month regarding some sort of...
Yeah, so the city has put forward a plan that would eliminate 80% of the land that is... zone for amusement, and then on top of that, they would allow high rises on the edge of surf. So when you arrive at the station, rather than seeing this display of amusements, what you're going to see is a wall of high rises. And then behind those high rises, what you're going to see is a sort of mall. They call it an entertainment mall. They say they have indoor amusements. But it's, you know, it quacks like a duck and it walks like a duck. It's a mall. And then behind that, you're going to see the little sliver that is left of the amusements in Coney Island. Everything that is west of the stadium will be fairly large-scale residential and commercial development. So we've been trying to convince the city to increase the area that is devoted to outdoor amusements, which is really what Coney Island is all about, and to, if they must, build those high-rises, build them elsewhere where they don't create this barrier between people and the amusements, and where they don't really destroy this seaside atmosphere of that makes Coney Island so wonderful. So their plan has been approved by the Planning Commission, and the City Council is going to vote on it in a little bit over a month. The council member of the district is Council Member Recchia, but calling him and calling your own representative would help a great deal. All the information is on our website, safeconeyisland.net. If you're interested in volunteering or getting involved, you can reach us through that site. And
okay, so a little over a month, like, okay. When, like, about when? Like, in the middle of
July?
End of July. And I helped last year hand out lots of flyers at the end of the summer. And are y'all going to have some good ones for the Mermaid Parade?
Yeah, we're going to have a bunch of volunteers there with very nice-looking placards that say, "Don't shrink Coney, fix the plan."
Yeah, what about, any flyers, perhaps, that would have... the city council people's contact info on them?
Well, there's a lot of council folks, but we have a bunch of postcards that can be sent to us, and then we're going to sort them and deliver them by address and deliver them to the respective council members. In addition to that, our website has all that information, and we'll be giving out a bunch of stickers with our website, directing people to
okay,
that as well.
Because last year, when I handed out those flyers, me and, like, one other dude, we handed out, like, 10,000 in one. I mean, it was crazy how many we handed out in one day. People were, like, stopping and turning around on the boardwalk and, like, holding out their hand, being like, "Can I have one? Can I have 10? We were talking to, like, children of schools and, like, telling them, like, if you want to, like, do a project for your class and get really popular in your class, I mean, tell me how fun it is to go to Coney Island in the summertime. You can... be a part of history and help save Coney Island by just having your whole class write a letter." And, like,
that's
there
right.
Was the addresses on the of, like, the mayor and, like, a couple other. It was those blue flyers that had, like, the picture from the Mermaid Parade of, like, the dude dressed up as Thor from Thor Equities, and it was
right.
Really cute. Those ones. And actually, Lola had them at her store, and I guess if anybody wants to help Flyer, are they going to be available at Lola's store again and also at the Coney Island thing under the cyclone?
We are going to be meeting. There's going to be one of our coordinators is going to be standing right on Surf Avenue, right in front of the cyclone by the History Project, and they're going to have all the materials there. We'll be collecting signatures, and we'll be passing out flyers and placards.
Cool.
Would you give the website out one more time?
Yeah, saveconeyisland.net.
Awesome.
And if you go there, you can see the renderings of what those buildings would look like and what the city's plan would look like. And there are all these buttons on the left that allow you to write to your representative and volunteer and all the other information that you need.
I mean, that's so crazy because like, all right, like let's say like what you were saying, like somebody comes to a hotel for one day and they see what they see at Coney Island and then they're like, huh, and they move on. I think hotels want returning visitors.
Oh yeah, it's completely backwards logic. It undermines the very thing that would attract people to go down there to begin with. But the city is convinced that is the way to induce development right away, which is also not something that you mean, particularly in this economy. If you're trying so desperately to attract people to develop something, what ends up happening is that you let them have all kinds of concessions. You let them build whatever it is they want because that's the only way they'll build anything, rather than think that this is a place that you're trying to develop for, you know, not for 2 years from now or 5 years from now, but for 50 years from now, for 40 years. We're talking before about how Penn Station was destroyed a little bit over 40 years ago, and people are still lamenting that. That doesn't seem to be the far-reaching view, far-reaching perspective that
you know what I really miss? The library in Alexandria.
You mean the old one?
Yeah, the one that was burned down by Erostratus.
Oh, that's
you know that one. I really miss that. You know. It was a great destruction of important cultural material, and we're still, thousands of years later, the worst.
Oh, my God. I was like, what are you talking about?
I was not around back then. But
Well, I wasn't either. But did you ever think about all of the destruction of valuable things, things that ought to have been preserved?
Right.
I wonder what the government has to worry about regarding destruction if they destroy Coney Island, because, I mean, really it's in their best interest to keep Coney Island the way it is, because right now it's satisfying the masses and the poor working class, and to satisfy and keep them submissive and satisfied, you know, is a good thing, because right now I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Coney Island is the only place in all five boroughs where you can get there to the beach via a subway, and the location has
right.
both a beach that's free, a boardwalk, and rides.
That's right.
All the lines used to end up there. Every single one of them, practically.
And it's free. And, like, everybody gets along. I mean, I've never even seen a child cry for more than 10 seconds, and usually it's a child that is about 3, and they want to either be held or a bite of ice cream, and then within 10 seconds they either get held or a bite of ice cream and they stop crying. I mean, it's like everybody, I've never seen an argument or anything. I mean, I go there a lot and I love it, and it's amazing. There's some sort of odd phenomenon. I hear there's an urban legend about some sort of higher ion levels in the air.
Yeah, negative ions.
Water, but I think that's been disproved.
Negative ions are, they say, generated around running water.
Mm-hmm.
And you're supposed to feel better.
Yeah, I know, but I think I saw part of a documentary about Niagara Falls, and some scientist was like, that's not true.
Well, that was
I don't know. I certainly feel good when I go to Coney Island.
Coney Island started, when it started becoming popular, was in the 1850s. It was not nearly as popular as it eventually became, but back then what made it popular was this fad that took over New York, a fad for saltwater bathing.
And taffy.
And saltwater taffy.
And taffy. Mm-hmm. All right, guys, have a good night.
Thank you.
You pave paradise and put up a parking lot with a 20-year tax abatement.
You're on the air. Hello? You're off the air. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm lowering the radio. Isn't the Bloomberg says he's not a guy that can be bought by special interests, but apparently he is.
No, he is.
There was a mayor who wanted to go against him.
But he's the special interest in himself. Yeah.
And I think anyone who wanted to go against this mayor would just do this story, saying what a fraud his commercials are. He is a guy who is of a special interest and wants to destroy the most creative thing that has ever been in New York City history. Now, I understand that the steeplechase itself is somewhere in storage. And if ever there was an artist, it would be someone who would go for mayor to bring up this story, how this Bloomberg would destroy the Coney Island. Hello?
Yeah.
I'm waiting for a response.
Well, I was thinking, did you grow up in New York City?
Of course I did.
And did you go to Coney Island?
And I went to the steeplechase. I even rode on those horses that surrounded the building.
Well, you know,
I remember that. I'm waiting for somebody to bring that back.
You know, one of the days that I knew I was, a pretend man, that I was going to be a man, was when my uncle took me to see Tirza. Does that name ring a bell?
No, it doesn't. What is that?
Tirza and Her Wine Bath, which was a Coney Island event. I mean, it was a carnival barker. See her, the rain, the wine rolls down her curves, and she dances. Yes, she dances in the It was sounded great. Really did sound great. A little messy, but it sounded great, you know. And so I went to see it, and there was this a lot of cellulite. No, and not that there's anything, you know, so repulsive about cellulite, but it wasn't what I had hoped for, and it wasn't even wine that was on her. It didn't even smell like wine. You couldn't even, I mean, I stuck my finger out, and I got a couple of drops of it on me, and it wasn't wine. It was just colored water. So it was a rip, but it was a moment of, reaching for some kind of maturity. I don't know.
I remember the magic carpet ride.
Oops, sorry. Didn't mean to do that. You're on the air. Oh. You're on the air. How does he do that? You're on the radio. How does he do that? You're on the radio. Are you there?
Yeah. It's just one last comment.
Sure.
The comment I have is the city had another plot of ground not far from Coney Island, as I read in the paper, and they were going to make that into a park or something. Do you know anything about that?
No, he's gone now, Phil.
Oh, he's gone.
Yeah, but you can go to their website. And
well, anyway, I don't have any computer. But anyway, I want to say this, that just maybe it was, instead of turning that into a park, maybe because it was supposed to be a pretty big plot of ground. And maybe what they can do is they can build their buildings over there.
Listen.
And leave Coney Island alone.
They're not going to listen to you call up on this radio station at 2:30 in the morning and then forget about it tomorrow. If you want to campaign for that great idea, you know, it might make some sense. But if just to suggest it here, you know, I don't even, maybe some other people will pick up the idea. It's not a bad idea, but, you know, something more is required. You're on the radio.
Yes, good morning. This is Dave from Astoria. I'm just amazed at the stupidity of the city, particularly the hoteliers. How many hotels did you plan to put up in the Coney Island area? Five or six of them, I heard, or correct me.
I believe so, yeah.
Well, if you put up one hotel with 500 rooms each, 500 times 12, 500 times 6, won't you be drawing business from Manhattan to go to Coney Island? Or are they anticipating that many tourists coming to New York to visit Coney Island? Or is this all tax write-offs? I.e., I have a friend of mine who owns three, what do you call them, oh, goodness gracious. They're timeshares.
Yeah.
They're in hotels. Hotels in Las Vegas that aren't doing anything. Follow me? So it's what the hotels do is that they sucker in people on these timeshares, knowing that they have a percentage of rooms that just don't sell.
Right, and Trump's casino is bankrupt.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So, I mean, this it appears to me this is just nothing but tax write-offs. Like I had listened, great show as always.
Thank
tax
you.
Abatements, tax this, tax give everybody tax write-offs, and blah, 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 blah. And then on top of that, the hotels come in, put up 550 rooms. Well, I figure that, you know, 12 months out of every year, I can only keep at 100% occupancy rate 8 months out of the year. The rest, it's all write-offs.
And they're kept there, and they're warehoused.
Yeah, yeah. I just it's frustrating. It's absolutely frustrating. And also, there's you guys mentioned this evening about holes in Manhattan where developers go bankrupt and so forth. So just go to Herald Square, right by Manhattan Mall. There was a building that had been there for years. It had a little great little burger joint, and it had this. All these jobs gone, and the hole sitting there, and the Wasserman. I could be wrong on the last one, but the developer is bankrupt. He ran out of money. How do you knock down a whole city block in the city of Manhattan or anywhere in the world, knock it down, get rid of all those people, and then go to the city there? I'm bankrupt. I'm bankrupt. How can you do something like that? I did a one-man picket last week for a day. You think anyone walked over to me and said, you know, and no one said nothing. They all freaking ignored me. But we have to do something. You know, I'm trying to.
Look, I want to tell you something. If you can, if you got a minute.
Yes, sir.
You know about Bertolt Brecht? You know,
yes, sir.
Bertolt Brecht was. He was an anti-Nazi in Berlin just about the time that the Nazis were, you know, building the army, and he left very soon afterwards. But one of his poems goes, I set my little theater up beside the troop train. All day long they marched by onto the train, heads down, sullen, not looking up. Today, one of them rolled an eye in my direction. I'll be back tomorrow.
No. Another example. I give two quick examples. Today I was in the cross on M23. There was a veteran there who was in tears because he had to go to the Veterans Administration. He was talking about his experiences in Vietnam. I was the only character out of a whole freaking New York City bus that had the spine to sit there and cry with this veteran holding his hand about bombs and blowing up over here and talking about the effects and he's having a hard time holding a job. Meanwhile, there was a lady they were trying to talk to who paid no mind to him. Except she said, well, Van, I lived in World War II. I know what bombs are. But that's not the point. Three, yesterday afternoon I have on my Coolpix camera, two undercover cops busted some kid doing something. I want to know, I've already submitted a copy of the photograph that I had because I carry a camera with me. I want to know why one of the undercover vice cards has on his right shin SS runes as a tattoo with some sort of a Slavic title under it. The excuse
what,
I get...
The iron...
the SS...
What was the Hungarian Nazi... group called the Iron Cross or the Iron Sword?
Well, the only thing I could tell you is that it has SS runes tattooed on his shin with some sort of Eastern European wording out of it. I submitted it to the civilian complaints report along with the four photographs that I took with it, bashing the kid up on the wall. And I asked, of course, his buddy told me to put the camera down. So anyway, and I asked the cop, and the cop tells me, well, this is what these guys have to do. They have to wear these obnoxious tattoos on their faces and their body in order to get infiltrated. But SS runes, give me a break, guy.
Thanks for the call, man.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah. You're on the air. You're on the air. Oops. Could be you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's sad to see Coney Island go, because throughout the world, Coney Island is known. It's a kind of a international word. Some people don't even know what Coney Island is, but they heard what about Coney Island. Right. When I came here in 84, I was taken there by a lady, and I went into a thing called the Global... I can't remember now, but you went in there, you stood up, and when this thing started spinning, the floor came
right
over under you.
Right.
And you were pasted onto the wall by right by the revolution.
By right.
And that was an experience. And I was a big person. It was not only for children. I went up into the cyclone.
Well,
that thing was an experience.
It's an inkling of space flight.
Yes. Uh-huh. You see? And at any night of the day, of the year, well it opens during summer, but at any night when it's open, or day, you had thousands of people going there. It was the poor man's fun.
Yes.
You see? But anything for poor people, governments usually destroy because they do not have a control over everything. You see? They try to monopolize everything.
Well, try to keep WBAI alive.
Yeah, exactly. That is a thing like WBAI. They're trying to pull you off the earth now, too. But that's what's going on. And Coney Island was really, really... when my family comes from England, we took them there. We packed the car and took them up there, let them see. Everybody wanted to see Coney Island, you know.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti wrote a great poem called Coney Island of the Mind. It means something around the world.
It's so yes. When I was a little boy back home, I didn't know what it's called, and they used to bring some people from America, like a show, a puppet show, and they call it Coney Island. You know, that was the first time I saw this thing they call Candy Frost, where they take the sugar
and have it on a stick. Spun candy. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was the first time I saw it. And then they took the apples and they candy the apples,
right.
You see?
Right.
Children to come now in the future would know what that is. You know?
Thank you.
It is so sad.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't be sad. Fight against it.
Yes.
You're on the air.
Hello?
Oh, it's Aaron Kay, who lived in Coney Island.
I used to live in Coney Island.
Yeah, you got landlorded out.
Yes, I got scumlorded out. Yeah. Anyway, it's really a drag what's going on down there with these speculators trying to rape the area. Hey, I took my kids there when they were little to Coney Island, and believe me, they enjoyed it. Ski ball. The rides. I never rode the Cyclone because I admit I'm chicken and afraid of heights. But they enjoyed Astroland and all the other rides. And there's all these little secondhand stores along Surf Avenue. You know, remember those, Bob?
Sure I do. Sure I do.
Yeah. Yes.
And I remember the subway station. And
Stillwell Avenue.
Yep.
Yeah. And I remember on a good day taking the kids and walking down the boardwalk, checking out the scenario, the joggers, the handball players, just everything.
Yep.
And what do they want to do? Make it look like South Beach. South Beach. You know, I haven't been to South Beach since the 70s, but Coney Island is a historical site as far as I'm concerned.
You're absolutely right, Aaron.
and that they have no right to rape that area and make it look like something plastic.
You're going to go to the mermaid parade?
I don't know. You know, I went to the one last year, but my mobility is not that great these days. Mm. And maybe if I get a ride down there, I will. But speaking of parades, there's a sort of a parade happening in New Mexico right now as we speak. The Rainbow Gathering is starting up. And the Forest Service law enforcement is already starting to harass the people going in. You know, shaking out of vehicles, you know, searches with the dogs, all that kind of nonsense. And last year, those same clowns actually came to Kid Village with their guns and their paintballs and tear gas because they were looking for somebody who's giving away free medical marijuana. And already they're starting up. And there are illegals already trying to get this thing stopped. I mean, they went and got a permit, and the law enforcement are still playing that kind of nonsense.
Well, why don't they have the Rainbow Gathering in one of the states where marijuana has been more or less legalized?
What's happening is.
And call it a health spa.
If they did it, say, on state land, keep the Forest Service out of it, that'd be a different ballgame. Mm-hmm. But it's on U.S. Forest Service land, mm-hmm. anywhere in the country. Do you remember three of our friends did 90 days in jail for that?
Yeah, sure. Joni Freedom.
Derek Beck and Stephen Principal.
She was Joni incarcerated.
Yes, Joni incarcerated.
Yeah.
Because they would not sign a permit to use people's land.
Right, and because they said, who are the leaders? And they said,
no,
we don't have any leaders. They said, you're the leader.
And so the Forest Service clowning John Carpenter went to the U.S. Attorney to file these charges. He got dragged to trial, and you're fined $500. They serve 90 days in federal jail. And how many more people need to go down because of this? That's the thing. I mean, Garrick's already got the land trying to hold together with the Rainbows.
Garrick Beck is one of the organizers or the unorganizers of the Rainbow.
A focalizer. He's not a leader, he's a focalizer.
A focal point.
Yes.
Okay,
and,
Aaron, thank you. I'm going to go on to some other calls. There's somebody who's chanting, waiting to get on the air.
Okay, good enough. Keep on chanting till I get on.
You're on the air. Oh, hell, yo. You're on the air.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
Okay. How are you?
So keeping on topic tonight, the devastating changes of New York regions and just what they're doing, everything. You know, I was walking down the Bowery the other day, what the Bowery used to be. Now they got these, like, glass kind of, like luxury towers there with, like, two kind of, like, white doormen, like, right on the Bowery and, like, 2nd Street, which used to be, like, vacant lots. So I guess it's progress in a way. But the other thing that I find is that, you know, there used to be these marvelous little engravings on you know, just like the general, like, old-style New York brownstones in the building. The basic architecture that used to be so beautiful have been completely removed. Like, like the stoops of some brownstones have been completely moved out. I think there was, like, a whole block on 78th Street that used to be nothing but, like, these marvelous stoops, and they just, like, removed every one of them just to, like, empty up the block or something. Like, I don't know why, you know? But they also used to have these engravings of the Green Man on doorways. I don't know if you've ever noticed that.
The Green Man?
Yeah, like, you know, the guy, the bearded character. It could have been Zeus. It could have been...
Oh, you know, well, it's not... You know who the Green Man
Yeah, it's very pagan.
No. You know who Albert DeSalvo was?
The Boston Strangler.
Yeah, one of the names that they gave to this person that they were hunting for was the Green Man, because he dressed in green. So they have a picture on the wall of a green man?
No, the character, the bearded character, I think sometimes it's also known as Zeus. It depends upon what the architecture was. Just like, you know, the engravings that used to be on the head of the doorway of just like, you know, this ratty little brownstone that's in the area. And I used to notice, I remember taking a picture of it, and then going by and seeing it gone. I mean, someone had just scraped it off, like it didn't really matter. And then I remember talking to somebody at a party that said he was in the know of, like, one of these.
They probably ripped it off and sold it.
No, he's saying, like, all the ornaments that used to be on buildings and like, parts of the World Trade Center, all that Art Deco stuff and, like, early art and, like, you know, probably Deco Pepsi signs and all the spectaculars from, you know, old Times Square are all in some storage facility somewhere, you know, in, like, Williamsburg, Brooklyn or something. And he says you go out there and you can see all the giant icons of yesteryear that are just, like, there for some reason. It's just really weird. But the other thing I want to do, like, a footnote on, I called in a couple of times and mentioned the trees that were missing from Riverside Park in the upper area between 96 and 110. And I noticed, like, usually happens, you know, and I called in a couple of times. I don't think anyone ever mentioned it or anything like that. It's just literally hundreds of trees have been missing within a couple of weeks or something. It was like
is that why they have some trees with, like, little fences around them so they won't escape?
I don't know. It's like maybe it's part of that beetle. Yeah. Maybe it was the Dutch elm or, you know, as I think you mentioned, actually, you know, that it was, like, storms or something. But it was obviously then I heard on the news it was, like, you know, the regular TV news that it was people have been actually stealing trees from
all the trees, put them in Manhattan tree museum.
And I figure, like, well, maybe these people are just, like, you know, it's like somewhere oak trees and whatever, like really big, old, like couple hundred-year-old trees, like really tall trees. And they must have been, like, I mean, obviously sawing them down with, like, non-power saws or something, like just hand saws or something. But maybe the city was doing it or something. Well, maybe people were doing it because
Are there stumps left or?
Yeah, the stumps are clean gone and everything's gone.
The stumps are gone, so they uprooted the trees. Maybe,
well, it seems like maybe
to plant them on their patio
too. Yes, like some sort of like something going on. I don't know how they removed so many trees in such a short amount of time. It's like, I'm talking hundreds, because it used to be a time when
it's a hungry
you couldn't
beetle.
See the Jersey Shore and. Now it's like there's like it's like wide open, and I used to go there to see the trees, and it's like, now all the trees are gone. That's like one thing, and it's like that's close to that 110 development, you know, Michigash over there. So it's just you're right. It's a corporate attack on individual. It's a war, and if you don't think it's a war, it is, and it's basically like it's something that doesn't even have a face really, because you can't really pin down who's owning what and who's, you know, how many lawyers are being hired to do what for just individuals to just completely bulldoze people in the name of progress. And what really happens is that you know, they say they're going to create jobs, but what really creates jobs is, like, you know, some contractor, fat cat contractor will get a job, and then they'll subcontract and subcontract out, so they'll end up paying themselves, like, you know, $1 million to hire somebody else, $10,000 to do, you know, a really, really crappy job. And I used to do, like, sheetrocking work and that type of stuff, and I'm not the most mighty in guy. I'm more T than mighty, actually. But, you know, I could have run up the stairs with, like, two of those sheetrocks, like, just by myself, you know, and I guess each of them weigh, like, I don't know, 60, 80 pounds or something like that. You know, run up the stairs with, like, two of them. And now I see, like, four guys can hardly carry one up the stairs. So it's like that's basically what you're getting. And some of these guys, it's very dangerous to walk past the construction site. I live up here where the crane fell over on 91st Street. I don't know if you heard that.
Yeah, sure. There were a few.
Well, I know
there was one week where we lost three cranes.
The whole block was affected.
Yeah,
and it was like
people.
I knew people that lived in a building, and I think, like, one person died.
Yeah.
Not to mention the guy actually, nobody in the building died. He was just, like, hurt. But just, like, everybody in the building got displaced, and it's just, like, I mean, that particular building, you could just walk by and you could just, like, you know, the guys that are standing around there, you could just, like, sense the negativity, you know, talk about negative ions, sense the negativity and corruption, and it's like the guys are sitting around like, you know, like, and it's just like nothing is going on, but these guys are making money. Those guys are making money. And these buildings are being built, and they're all 70%, like, unrented because nobody can afford it. That one on Astor Place, that you know, it's like $1 million condo or something like that.
And then there was one development that they claimed had $30,000 apartments in it that was given, more or less, to homeless people. And the city,
said about Trista Dora? I was on that waiting list, and then Madonna and Farrah Fawcett move in.
And then the city was paying what they called market value for the places for these homeless people to be situated in homes. You know, but market value, that's thousands of dollars a month.
Well, no one creates that. Maybe we should all go to Cuba or something, huh? I don't know. What creates this market? It just destroys people. And some people benefit.
Well, the rent control laws have a lot to do with it. The legislature has a lot to do with it.
Well, yeah, now we have this clown show in Albany where people are going to start slapping each other like you see in a Korean parliament or something like that. It's very silly. And another thing I have to point out, is there a Democrat that has not been, like, foisted out of office by some sexual scandal? I mean, is that like a thing? Is that like a conspiracy or something? I don't know.
But look at all the Republicans that are being...
Well, it seems to be okay if you can afford the whorehouse or something. I don't know what it is. I mean, okay, here's another thing. Let me just point out some things, and I'll talk quick, and I'll get off the air. Do you know what the two lions at the public library represent? Have you ever thought about that? Like, they're symbols. They're symbols that, like, you think mean something, but what they really mean is, like, a hidden meaning.
Well, tell me. I'm
well, okay, just go on symbols.
Like I used
you
to
know, the swastika used to be a holy symbol for Hindus.
Uh-huh.
And I also point out that the peace sign, like, as we know, in a circle, a broken cross, was originally, and don't take my word for it, there's a book called The Book of Symbols that explains all this stuff and, you know, the Nazi cross and all this kind of stuff. So the actual peace sign that we know is a broken cross upside down, which is originally a symbol of Satanism. So the other weird thing that kind of stands out, you know the Superman symbol, the big red S? People usually walk around with that T-shirt, like, I'm Superman or whatever. And the guy that created Superman actually said this. It's like, where did he get the big red S? Because superheroes usually, you know, wear symbols on their chest, and before that, you know, there weren't any superheroes, I guess, before Superman, but... Where did he get the big red S? In medieval times, when people were accused of a crime, they were branded with a red letter.
Scarlet letter.
Like
right.
The Scarlet Letter. Like, you know the Scarlet Letter, right? So
right.
S stood for Satanism. If you were, like, caught with black magic and that kind of stuff, they'd brand
did
you with
Siegel
an S.
Did Siegel and Shuster say this?
What?
Did Siegel and Shuster say this?
Yeah, that's where he said he got the idea. I forget who said what and who thought the idea for what. But that's where he got the idea, the Scarlet Letter. And branding people for whatever crime that they did or something like that.
So
then the other thing, let me leave on a lighter note. I just heard the George Carlin, the last George Carlin CD.
Yeah.
And I'm going to quote from him, and it's not dirty. But he basically said, we have sold ourselves out. The whole soul of America has been cheaply sold out by trinkets, cell phones, and, you know, Walkmans and iPods and that kind of stuff.
Wampum and
right.
Beads.
And then the other quote, more nefariously, and I don't really advocate William Burroughs, but I will quote from him. And this is from Drugstore Cowboy. Everyone should watch that. And I think it's the Thanksgiving blessing video that he did or something like that. But the actual direct quote is like, the only reason is that there is a war on drugs is so that the police can have control over the population. And it has nothing to do with actually war on drugs or the partaking of drugs or anything like that.
That's the one from 1986 where he's...
Yeah, I don't know the exact quote, but
yeah.
Something like that.
Thanks.
But you should get that, the last George Carlin CD, I think it's called It's Bad For You.
Hmm.
And it actually doesn't have that too many curses, but there are some direct quotes, one of them being like, we've basically sold ourselves out for cheap trinkets. And we're a shallow version of what we used to be, and I guess it's like we're not fighting as much as we should about stuff. And the other thing I want to point out is, like, okay, like, who is the most liberal hero? Okay, think about it. It's Al Franken and Michael Moore. So it's like, are these the only clowns that are allowed to stand up
and wavy gravy?
Yeah, that's the other problem I have. It's like these old guys. Look, man, you're not going to fight corporate leviathans with hippie farts, dude. I mean, you're just not going to do it. And I've seen it happen. I'm a generation like younger than you guys, and you kind of, you know, you made some promises. Everyone makes promises about stuff, and it's like, aren't those Chicago 7 guys basically Yuppies now or something, except for Abby Hoffman?
Abby Hoffman is dead.
No, Jerry Rubin
is dead.
Abby Hoffman, well.
And Keith, well, you know, I can go down the list. Dave Dellinger is dead.
Isn't Jerry Rubin working on Wall Street or something?
No, Jerry Rubin was hit by a car in Berkeley.
Who was the guy that went all corporate? They did a big thing about him.
Jerry Rubin did go to work on Wall Street for a time.
Well, there you go.
Well, that's
all
one.
All kinds of characters on
but
that,
that's one guy out of eight. So you said all because
well,
you're so depressed.
Yeah.
You're right. But more than just that,
only,
I mean, you have Carl coming on. You have a
who?
Aaron. Remember Carl calls in?
Sure, sure.
Yeah, I like him. He's amiable. But sometimes he's just like, he was talking about the cop harassing him and cops harass him, but he was very antagonistic, and it was just like, it's an endless struggle. You don't have to struggle either. You could just walk down the beach and see the beach hit the sand and laugh at both sides of it. Kind
Carl
of.
Will admit to you that he has an anger management problem.
Well, Carl has a lot of problems, and I think a lot of people's problems on BAI, not to mention egotism, and talk radio is basically like mudslinging. Basically, is that everyone,
shut up?
Yeah, everyone's so self-satisfied, and I'm sitting on a lozenge and. Oh, isn't it wonderful about this? And it's just like, oh, my God. And then once and then you get some fringe dweller like me or Carl or whoever calls in and talks about their dusty little, like, you know, how I'm losing with the cheese war of the rats, you know, that kind of stuff, you know. So it's just, anyway, that's it.
What's your name?
What's my name? You keep on asking me my name, man. I'm Orson Welles. I'm the Shadow. Rather not give my name out.
Adios.
You know why?
No, why?
Because I piss off my brother. He hates it when I call in. So, and I also don't. You know, I'm losing faith, and I guess I'm losing my faith in listener participation. I guess sometimes, but I just have to call in and say, oh, I miss the green man faces, and I miss the trees, and I miss the human face. Of the world, you know, and trying to put a human face on this this blood sucking corporate
well, then you
war
definitely,
on individuals.
You definitely should go to see Steve in Israel at the Theater Lab,
okay.
June 26th, 27th, and 28th.
Thanks for the shameless promotion.
Yes, well.
Okay.
Bye bye. And you're on the air.
Yes, it's David Combs again. I've got several things to say, but let me first give you the best. It's a website, and I'll explain it after I give it.
Okay, before you do,
yeah?
This is WBAI in New York City.
Yes, sir.
KWMD in Casilla, Alaska.
Understood.
CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia.
That I didn't know.
WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hey, man, we're getting broad.
And we're bursting out of the World Wide Web in many places in this country tonight. Maybe we'll get a call from someone who's listening outside of the New York City area.
Maybe that the moon.
Maybe.
There's a man up there.
Yeah.
Anyway,
okay, now go ahead.
Lindeman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N, dot, Progressive Radio Network, all one word, progressiveradionetwork.org.
Lindeman?
Lindeman, his name is Steve Lindeman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N, dot, progressiveradionetwork.org. Now, you remember Gary Null? He's got a whole bunch of money. He's been very successful. And what he has done since he got off of WBAI thrown off. He started this, well, he's done a lot of things, but he started something called the Progressive Radio Network. And he actually has a bunch of programs on the thing, on the, there, not radio, it's on the radio someplace, but it's on the net. And, so anyway, this thing is really good. It's every morning at, 9 o'clock, but I just get the MP3 and use it while walking the dog. The guy is really, really good. Have a listen. I mean, I can't. He really, he and his friends and the people he get, whom you've all heard of, a lot of them, they really dump on Mr. Obama. I mean, calling him Bush 3, et cetera, et cetera. But, well, I mean, I could talk about other things, but I
may, may I just tell you something?
Yes, sir.
I was the first person to put Gary Null on the air.
Thank you.
I know. Buzzy Linhart, who was a great musician, was working as a, I don't know, a cook for this guy, Gary Null, who had a health food store.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought Gary Null
Fertile
around.
Earth, I think its name was.
Yeah, I think so. And I put him on the air. So I know about him. I have some mixed feelings about him, but generally I think he has helped many people. He's also he's also said some things that are hard to understand in terms of reality.
Okay, but let me say he is a very unreasonable man. But as they say, it's. Without unreasonable men, you'd have no but nothing, right? I mean, it's those guys who do things. At any rate, I've started listening to him again. And, well, again, I never did, but I have for the last year. And he's about half politics and half health stuff. Well, some of his health stuff is crazy. He talks about quantum mechanics, and all, which he knows nothing about. But at any rate, his political stuff is unbelievable, and he gets the same people on, like Parenti and Chomsky and all these guys on. He has interviews with them, and he reads articles over the air, it's something different than what it was on BAI. I wish we could get him back onto BAI, because that thing at noon, except for Friday, Friday is really great, this two-story.
Well, it's not up to me, but there are some people who are campaigning very hard for that. And I want to say something else, too, now that you mentioned WBAI and our changes, the changes that we're going through. There is an article, I understand, in this week's Villager, by Paul DiRienzo.
I know him.
And I'm sure that about 50% of it, at least, is true.
Okay.
I might even agree with some of it.
I can't stand the people. I guess someone said it was Bernard's own doctor or something, the guys we have on at noon. Friday is very, very good.
Excuse me. I would prefer not to talk about personalities,
okay,
if you don't mind.
But I prefer to have.
I listen to that program, and I think the guy.
Well, you
is,
like it very good.
I can tolerate it. I think he's coming from a good place. I think that maybe he doesn't belong on the radio, but he's coming from a good place. I'm sure he's helping people.
One of those guys talks about the New England Journal, and he has a name for it. I forget what it is. There's two guys, but one of them has a funny name for the New England Journal of Medicine, like implying they're fraudulent, which is very, very good. And let me ask you a question. Who, you said, shut up, and about the coup. Who was the guy who kept saying, say goodbye, awful person?
I think I know who you mean. Yeah, he's no longer
Earth. He's no longer on the planet. He
good.
Well,
what was his name?
Clayton Riley was his name.
That's it. God, awful.
And one of the first times I met him, he attacked me.
I've heard other people too.
He was a professional prize fighter, I understand.
Really?
Yeah. Although he did have good taste in jazz, I will say that.
Mm. Well, you want to do your three-way calling or ten-way calling? I'll stay on.
No, I'm going to just go on to some single calls, if you don't mind. And thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have some good guests on. Thank you. Listen, I don't know if you mentioned it, but I missed you the first 20 minutes. But I would just like to say congratulations. I heard on the report to the listener that one of our old buddies, one of the smart, heart-centered folks, are coming back, Robert Knight.
Looks that way. I talked to him a couple of nights ago, and he's really not sure himself what's going to happen.
Oh.
And he's not sure under what circumstances he wants to come back. But he did a great program. And he was fired in a very unfair and devious way.
Yes, I remember in your comment a few weeks ago of where he was accused of playing too much white music, and of course, Robert, being the intellectual he is, he was able to base it on showing the history of music, and so that was very revealing. Where for me, I was very disappointed where it went. It really showed the content of the character a bit lacking in the person who made that comment to him. And I'm happy to say that he's not there anymore, and the station's thriving again, even though he kept saying
it was. Well, I wouldn't say we're thriving, but we're struggling more successfully than previously.
Yes, most successful in what, 12?
I believe we could be on the mend.
Yes, well, and those 800,000 people who don't have the access to TV, there's a... Come on over to Radio Land, folks.
Mm.
Wouldn't that be something? How do we get them?
Well, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Take care.
You're on the air.
Yes, Ms. Bob says, Mr. Seth, is it your birthday at the end of June? That's what I heard of it, really.
Yeah.
And happy birthday, happy birthday.
Thank you.
I love the AI. Everybody send money. I'm sorry that Mr. Don DeBall quit. I hear him on the newsline for the blind. Sometimes the NFT newsline. I think he's one of the people that does the grocery ads. And I love the AI, and thank you. Happy, happy birthday. Good night.
Thank you. Thanks for remembering. And you're on the air.
Hi. Would you mind if we ask me... you a little bit about Jerry Rubin, because I know that you knew him and were friends with him at one time, weren't you?
I was.
So what happened?
After the trial, and after the appeal, and after he was vindicated and lionized, I think he kind of lost a little of his nerve. And he decided that it was better, if you were smart, to make money in this country.
So
he went to work on Wall Street for, I don't know what he was doing.
He was doing networking parties over at Studio.
That was later. He had, after he left Wall Street, he threw these networking parties. And then for a while, very brief time, he and Abby went out as a pair of lecturers, the Abby and Jerry Show, they called it. And Abby was the yippie and Jerry was the yuppie. And they talked about, you know, how to live one's life. And
it was around the same time as Liddy and Leary on the circuit.
That's right. That's right.
What year was this? 82, about?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, because I met him. I worked for him in his networking parties, and he was very quiet the whole time. We were a bunch of actors who were hired to do invitations for his networking parties.
Uh-huh.
And after he was killed, I thought about that time that I met him. I said, you know, sometimes people had judgments about him. They thought he sold out. And I wonder if we all know the whole story, and that's why I was asking you, because he seemed very paranoid.
Well, you know, I don't know about sold out, but I think his soul was taken out. There was a time when I lived in the area where he was having one of his network parties. And I had been having some rough times. I had been thrown off the air at WBAI,
mm-hmm.
and was, you know, I really needed a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him in the street with some of his friends outside of one of these parties. And I said, "Hi, Jerry. Hi, how are you?" And he turned his back on me.
Yeah, I remember you told us that once before.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever ask him why he did that?
I never spoke to him again. He went to California, and he was hit by a Volkswagen.
Crossing La Cienega Boulevard.
Mm.
But the last time that I remember seeing him, he was actually back in New York, because Mario Savio, his old pal from Berkeley, was also on the East Coast. And they met, and Mario was at Columbia University giving a talk. And I don't think Jerry ever formally, that is F-O-R-M-A-L-L-Y, formally, I don't think he ever renounced his beliefs in the past. He may have contradicted them, perhaps. But he and Mario remained friends to the end, as far as I know.
Well, I just want to just reiterate that the only time I ever met him was working for his networking parties on the Upper East Side in a little small apartment, one of those little box apartments that all look the same. And I guess it was his wife, I'm not sure, and there's some other women mm-hmm. around. And he seemed very paranoid.
Mm.
So I just...
He was frightened, really frightened by what had happened to him.
Exactly, and I just wonder if we all... That's why sometimes people... You know, I mean, I know he jilted you or whatever. He, you know, he dissed you or whatever.
That isn't exactly the word.
But no, he dissed, well, whatever. He dissed you. Is that a good word for it? Or he didn't show you the kind of, he didn't give you the kind of greeting that you were hoping for when you said hello to him.
He and, snubbed me.
Yeah, he snubbed. But sometimes we don't always know the circumstances. For example, the guy who just called us says, "I wonder where they all are," didn't even know that he had been killed.
Mm.
You know, and nobody knows exactly the circumstances of what happened. Is it a bus accident or whatever, you know? I think it's important. You know, some people think Abbie Hoffman killed himself, you know?
Well, Dave Dellinger thought that he had been suicided.
To Abbie?
But, yeah, but Abbie's relatives and family are pretty sure that he did himself in.
And what about Jerry?
Walked out in front of a Volkswagen?
No.
I think he would have picked a... bigger, better car. You know, if you're hit by a small car, it's kind of agonizing. But if you're hit by a big car or a truck, I think it's quick.
All right. Well, anyway, I just wanted to just reiterate, like, the guy who was just calling didn't even know that he was dead.
That's right.
So that's why some people don't know anything.
Listen, there are people listening who don't even know that he was alive.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much. Bye.
Thank you.
You're on the air.
Hello, good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I just want to comment on the Jerry Rubin statement. And you may disagree with me, and the audience may disagree, but Jerry disturbed me when I was at a Free Bobby Seale rally up in New Haven years ago, and he got up on stage and talked about kill your mother, kill your... And I got turned off when he had problems long
ago. Well, I don't think he meant that. He explained later on that he didn't mean that literally. When he said kill your mother, it's the same. In Buddhism, they say if you meet your guru on the road, kill him.
Mm.
Which means really... you've been raised a certain way, but be prepared to be another way. You know, don't be so respectful of what has...
Oh, and by the way, I hear Thule's having health problems. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do.
Is he out of that home, whatever, home or whatever?
Yeah, Thule was in the nursing home in the West Village. He's had a stroke. But he is home, and he's writing music again.
Hey, you know what? He's one of the most unique guys.
Remember I played Ed Sanders' stuff tonight? Ed is going to be doing a concert for Thule.
Yeah, cool.
A benefit concert for Thule.
You know why I like him? It's because he tolerates assholes like me. You know, because a lot of people can't stand differing points of view. And Thule would stand there and go, oh, okay, yeah, all right. You know, like, it make you feel like, hey, if you said something stupid, now you want to reevaluate it, as opposed to coming down hard on you, you know? Anyway, Mr. Bob, I remember you being a pioneer in this radio medium. Is it singular? Medium.
No,
yeah.
The sons of the pioneers.
And
so
the thing is that...
Are
they documenting your stuff or what?
They're archiving it. Yeah.
So I'm talking about some of these young filmmakers with
cameras. Yeah, yeah. Well, they're archiving my material.
Yeah.
And it's coming along very, very well. It's in a database now. There are like thousands and thousands of programs that I can just call up by name, you know. And
maybe also in a database, too.
Yeah.
Let me go. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye. And you're on the air. You're on the air. And you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, hi, you're on the
air.
Good
morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I want to wish you a very happy birthday.
Well, thank you. You're a bit early, but thank you very much.
Well, I thought I'd get ahead of the trend, if that's possible. Be the first in line or something. I really just wanted to take this opportunity or excuse to thank you for so many years of great radio. And you seem cheerful tonight. Maybe it's something to do with BAI, or I don't know what.
I have my friend Robbie Barish, my friend Steve Ben Israel, my new friend Juan, and Bill Propp, who is one of my best friends right here with me tonight. And the audience has been wonderfully intelligent and made me happy. I've heard some good music tonight and great calls. Thank you.
That's fantastic, Bob. You know, while I was waiting to get on the air, I was reflecting on what other people were saying, and I had kind of a 3 a.m. revelation that sometimes politics is more fickle than culture. And some of your best friends today are people that you share culture with, like David Amram, who is a frequent caller to your show.
Yes, but, you know, politics is just the way you fight to live the kind of life you want to live.
That's true.
So your politics is what defends your culture. If your culture means that you want the libraries to be open, it becomes political.
That's true. I guess, you know, just like government is something you can't avoid or it's difficult to avoid, politics is difficult to avoid for our survival, but sometimes when politics becomes people's lifeblood, that politics can go bad on them and can create bad blood between people.
Well, you know, that's become when people become choked on their ideology. You know, they can't see anything but the strict outlines of their ideology.
I think it also happens when politics becomes too divorced from culture and spirituality and other things that make people feel alive.
All right, thank you.
Have a great night, Bob.
Thanks very much.
He's talking about reification. Watch.
You're on the air.
Hi there. Yeah, yes, Bob, it's been a very nice show, actually. I agree with you. Rather calm and intelligent for the most part.
Is that a surprise?
Yeah, because sometimes it's really... you're put upon sometimes by some of the callers sometimes. But with that said, you know, just a couple of quick comments about the topic. And as some listeners have pointed out, there are all these multi-million-dollar condos in all over Manhattan that aren't being occupied, and that fellow who was talking about Coney Island extensively, he was right. It's just a tax scam, and probably they'll be putting the wrecking ball to a lot of these towers, ironically, because they won't get occupied because, you know, believe it or not, there is a finite amount of money in the world, no matter how rich that many people are in Manhattan. You know, it gets a little silly after a while. But the reason I call is this. I mean, to paraphrase my grandmother, you know, when you, and this is where I think the intelligence of the people of New York City kind of took a walk when they elected Bloomberg. You got this rich guy. He's going to hang out with, have lunch with, and help his rich friends. I think the only time that there was an exception was Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm.
You know, it's just common sense. You know that he's in bed with Tishman Speer and the BlackRock Corporation and all these guys who are pulling, you know, out trees, leveling everything, putting up towers and making money hand over fist, and they don't give a GD about the people of this city. I mean, it's just common sense. You know,
I tell you something that Paul Krasner said about Rockefeller.
Yeah.
He said, you know, I would vote for Rockefeller if he made this promise, because he can afford to do it.
Right.
Whether I'm elected or not, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to build some schools.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to pay some librarians. I'm going to fix some roads. If Rockefeller had said that, then Paul would have voted for him. Now, Bloomberg is a multimillionaire. Multi-billionaire. He could do so much to improve the situation of the people in New York City.
And he won't.
He won't.
He once sent me a free radio in the mail.
Well, it
only got Bloomberg, by the way.
Yeah.
It was an AM station, yeah.
Now, you mentioned, you know, Rockefeller, and the really bizarre thing about this whole situation at this point in history is this, that the enfant terrible of capitalism, the guys who started it all, you know, old man John D. Rockefeller and that whole group, you know, that just were ruthless to labor before the labor movement started up, even these monsters had a sense of civic duty where they started the libraries and they did build some schools and they did some of this infrastructure stuff. And as horrible as they were, at least they did a certain amount of giving back. In the style of, let's say, Venetian Doge. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But there was this sense of civic something or other. All these guys do is just steal and ruin everything.
Mm. Well, what do we do?
I don't know. I mean, the dehumanization movement seems to be just, you know. Kirk, he's just bubbling right along right now, as the other gentleman was talking about.
Refuse to be burnt out.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, and by implication, stay away from all these distractions and toys, and try to live a valid life. You know what I mean?
Oh, right.
Yeah, that's all you can do. Anyhow, thank you for letting me vent. But don't vote for Bloomberg. My God, you know. That's one thing one can do. Vote for the other guy.
Well, we should be seeing Ibrahim Gonzalez or Ahmed Ali any moment now for In the Moment. And until then, more Chumbawamba. You know, I have a cat named Chumbawamba. I like them so much. Cats. Until Ibrahim comes in, until Ibrahim and Ahmed Ali come in, I want to take a moment to just talk about something that is sort of troubling me. It's kind of personal. I live in Staten Island on a street that's like one side of it is sort of semi-industrial and the other is, you know, homes. And some reason having to do with the fact that there were a lot of abandoned trucks probably in the industrial side of the street. There were a lot of rats that were around the trucks. And some person who didn't like the rats took a couple of stray cats and threw them into the place where the trucks and the rats were. And the cats prospered. And they had kittens, and they had kittens, and they had kittens, and they had kittens. And then the population of cats did in all of the rats. There were no more rats for the poor cats. And so people in the neighborhood, especially people who had cats, found cats coming to their door and asking to be fed.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.